Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cicerino back here to talk about Survivor's most arbitrary and reductive as we have gotten together once again for Outwit, Outplay, Outlist. Today, we're talking about Survivor's most iconic power couples, and we've got a lot to break down. Let me bring in my co-host, the co-creator of Outwit, Outplay, Outlist. Give it up for Mike Bloom.
And what a power couple we are, Rob, to yes. have parented this concept. Now going, what, like 7 or 8 of these iterations strong. I think just from a creator standpoint, we got to be in the top tier purely because of that.
Yes, I would think so. And Mike, you are a person that has many different people that you could be matched up with for a power couple, maybe even more than me in terms of podcast co-hosts.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we do on the sly. Of course, I love all of my co-hosts equally. They are all worth playing for, in my opinion. I just want to put that out there right here at the top. But yeah, I am no stranger to duos, personally. So I'm very happy to go through 20 years of Survivor and talk about some big pairs, some friends, some enemies, some frenemies, and everything in between today.
All right. Mike, happy to have you back here to talk some Survivor. And we have got a great iconic power couple with us to talk about all this. They've wanted to talk about duos. Here they are. Kevin and Nigel are here. Kevin and Nigel, how are you two?
We're doing great, Rob. You know, I actually got my second dose of the Pfizer vaccine earlier today. So
yes.
This might be your first podcast where someone can live report on the onset of vaccine side effects.
Okay. Ooh. All right. Keep us posted. Keep us posted if there's anything going on. Kevin, how are you?
Doing good. Nothing real new except apparently I might have to take care of him, which I did not sign up for. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
that's a part of being an iconic couple.
Yes.
All right. We haven't had anybody ever medevaced out of the podcast, and I don't expect today to be a first. So we will see. I've watched the half of Survivor Samoa. I've seen 2 medical evacuations, so I know what the symptoms are if either you have low blood pressure.
Don't get near the table maze, Nigel. Please don't. For God's sake.
All right. Of course, as I am teasing, we will on Wednesday night, of course, have our podcast of the Survivor Samoa, the 25th best season. Actually, by the time you're listening to this, you will probably be already able to hear it because this is coming out after that podcast. So check out our coverage of the 25th best season of all time, Survivor Samoa. All right. Outwit, Outplay, Outlist. Mike, how's everything going for you?
Everything is going well. You know, winter has turned to spring here on the East Coast. So we're very happy. Things are in bloom, which makes things, of course, very happy in terms of my brand. And I'm happy. You know, we are also on the crux of some new Survivor coming our way as well. We're a little over a month away from Survivor South Africa. So I have really started to look at some preseason content. There it is. Wild. That we're going to be talking about some new Survivor for the first time in a year plus, but we can always take the time to ruminate on some old Survivor as well through this fantastic series.
Okay. Kevin and Nigel, could you talk a little bit about why you want to talk about Survivor duos?
Well, I mean, we're an iconic duo, so it makes sense for us to think about the other duos and see how they compare to us. You know, I think we want to do it. I mean, like I said, we're a power couple, but I really want to ask the two of you, which of you feels most comfortable being part of our power thruple? And if that should be the next thing that we list.
Oh,
okay. I didn't realize there were applications out there. I would have prepared my resume.
Yeah. All right. Maybe why don't we just put our best feet forward and then maybe you two want to make the call at the end of the show.
I think that's a great plan. And, you know, I think if we just repeat the fact that we are an iconic Survivor duo, you know, maybe people will eventually start to
manifest. You manifest it. Okay. Of course that I know you two have been great on the B&B in the past, but just in case anybody is new and has not heard either of you on a podcast, do you want to give your backstory and how Survivor brought you together?
Go ahead, Nigel.
So I am from San Francisco originally. I moved to the Washington, D.C. area about 3 years ago. I did not know anybody in the area, really. So I think it was maybe just about a month or two after moving here, I saw that there was going to be a live watch party for the Ghost Island finale. And I figured that was a pretty good opportunity to try and make at least one new friend in the area that would have been considered a success for me. And he fell in love. And I will reiterate, I am now a part of an iconic Survivor power duo. Yes. That's actually the full story. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow. Whoever said that Ghost Island didn't bring people together?
I think that this relationship is the best thing to come out of Ghost Island.
it's been maturing for nearly 3 years at this point.
Hey, I didn't mind it on the rewatch. I thought that was pretty fun. Have we ever determined who's the bigger Survivor fan?
Oh, it's Kevin. I'm the bigger Survivor fan. Nigel hadn't only watched maybe half the seasons, I think, by the time we started dating, and I have made him rewatch almost all of them now. And just in time for the RTP countdown as well, so we're going to rewatch them all again. So he's really getting his fill, I think.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about our power duos. Mike, these are in chronological order once again.
Yeah, so we're going in chronological order some ground rules here. Duo quite obviously means two people. Yep. So we're going to be talking about two people. And these relationships run the gamut, right? These could be tight allies. These could be people who consistently butted heads, like two battering rams. Terry and Arish are not on this, but that's just a reference to it. But I think they really sort of span things from some of the most beloved to maybe some of the most contentious to maybe some of the most comedy filled. But I think as we approach some new Survivor coming our way in the fall in terms of US Survivor, it's also a fun opportunity to sort of refresh our brain of, okay, if you're looking for a number one on the island, especially if you want to go for that iconic level, as iconic as Kevin and Nigel, what's some of the criteria that you need to include in there if you want to be known in the annals of Survivor history?
Okay. All right. So Mike, who is up first?
I mean, we're going back to Borneo, as we always do. Unfortunately, Greg Buist was not able to make his way onto the countdown, as he has been very, very many number of times during this series of podcasts. But we're going to start in a very simple, very well-known place. So well-known, in fact, there was a callback to it 25 seasons later in the much beloved Karamoan finale. Of course, we are talking about Richard Hatch and Rudy Bosch.
Okay. The unlikely friends from Survivor Borneo. Rudy didn't want anything to do with Rich. Rich didn't really want too much to do with Rudy, but fate brought them together, and they had an unlikely friendship, which lasted many, many years. Rich and Rudy. Kevin and Nigel, what do Rich and Rudy do for you?
They instill hope for me. And, you know, I remember watching Borneo as a closeted child and being really fascinated with their relationship. And so we actually, you know, previewing the list of people that we're going to rank, we thought about what type of like nicknames, what would their Amazing Race like team be? And so for Rich and Rudy, we thought team Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And if that is too controversial, we also settle for team Rudy and Nudie. And
I like that one.
I love Rich and Rudy. I think they complement each other really well. And that's something very important to me, I think, when we were talking about how we're going to review these people, is that I really appreciate the uniqueness from two different perspectives coming together. And their unlikely bond is so fun. And, you know, I think that what's really great about Rich and Rudy is that they are the perfect encapsulation for that first season of Survivor, of bringing people from all different walks of life. You know, you would never have assumed Rudy and Rich would be a pair, but you get to see the beauty of learning to appreciate people that you probably never would have met in your life otherwise. But not in a homosexual way. That's
right.
For sure.
Certainly not. Certainly not.
Yeah, it's such a fun dynamic. Like you said, I mean, these two are, I mean, I would say that Rich and Sue are probably the more oil and water to begin with. This is like oil and, I don't know, like
sunscreen.
Yeah, exactly. Like something that sort of slides off, but doesn't necessarily stay on. But I think that as they sort of got accustomed to each other and that sunscreen got more rubbed on and assimilated itself more into the skin, then these two sort of became thick as thieves. I think Rudy respected Rich's work ethic, vice versa. There was sort of this fun little procedural element, right, where Rich catches the fish and then we go to Rowdy Rudy's diner and then they cook up the fish. And I think they also began to see eye to eye as well. Rich was the one to bring Rudy into that alliance that got them to the final four. And so I do think when you're thinking back to like big Survivor duos, who are two people who would pass each other on the street and either not acknowledge each other or like fervently move to the other side of the street to avoid that person's gaze, it probably comes back to Richard and Rudy Hatch always.
Yeah,
I even gave Rudy the last name of Richard. That's how insular they are together.
All right, let's look at the board and see where we might want to place Rich and Rudy, aka Nudie and Rudy. Let's see. Let me just go ahead and bring them up from the bottom, and let me share my screen. And so here we go. Mike, could you go through our four tiers?
Of course. So at the very tippy top, we've got worth playing for, which is the best of the best. In this case, the best of the best iconic Survivor power couples. My Life is Fine. Pretty good. Not excellent, but certainly, you know, above average. Ain't No Hershey Bar. Meh. It's okay. You know, I would not say it's as ratchet, as Rabba put it, as Forget You, Go Home, Goodbye. The bottom tier, Burn It With Fire, that Richard started as he does a little dance after winning an immunity challenge.
Okay. All right. So, Kevin and Nigel, where would you put Rich and Rudy?
I mean, I think they're at least My Life is Fine, though I really enjoy Worth Playing For because they're just so iconic. I mean, they really make the show into something special. I think Borneo is not itself without Rich and Rudy's dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, I think for myself, I would place them at My Life is Fine because, you know, as Kevin said, they are a really big duo in the history of this show. But I think that when you compare them to some other duos that we will be talking about a little bit later in this show, I don't know that they have a truly transcendent dynamic between the two of them. I think that, you know, as we get further along into this ranking, I think we'll see that they fairly fit into My Life is Fine.
Yeah. Mike, what do you think in terms of Worth Playing For, My Life is Fine?
I think this is worth playing for, personally. I can understand Nigel's comment that I think maybe there's not a lot of like moments between them that we necessarily think about, but also that's due to the style of Borneo, which, as people might remember, Borneo is done almost like in a documentary like format, right? We're very rarely seeing people interact in person. It's very much the confessionals, people being like, oh, I went to go see Richard at the water well today, and here's what happened. It's very much told in the past rather than seeing things in the present. So I do wonder if Borneo had been done in a modern editing style, if we would have seen more of those moments. But I mean, this really is such an originator of so many things. Like I said, it was referenced 25 seasons later in a pretty miserable variety, in my opinion, but the fact that it got echoed back, you know, 12 and a half years later just shows how this is the odd couple of Survivor, even 20 years later.
Yeah, I think it's worth playing for. Maybe it'll get bumped down as we go along into My Life is Fine, but to start things off, I think it's very much worth playing for to get things going. I mean, they had a very unique relationship. I mean, I got to spend time with both of these men on my trip to Argentina once upon a time. You know, there certainly was like an understanding, if not like that they were just like great friends, but they certainly like enjoyed each other's company. I mean, I feel like Rudy like is immediately surprised by Richard Hatch. I think that he says in the first season, you know, that what that guy Rich, he's fat, but he's good. About Richard Hatch, which was, turns out to be one of the least offensive things that he would say about Richard Hatch in that season. So,
and it also turns out Rudy, I mean, depends on what argument you want to make. Who was the fourth vote to give Richard Hatch the original Survivor win? In one world, you could argue it was Rudy, not in Survivor One World, but in one argument, you could say that Rudy was the one to do it, and it's because they were such a tight duo that despite Rudy's only jury statement being like, I just want to say I'm sorry for falling off the poll yesterday, he still ends up voting for Richard to win and makes him the first Survivor winner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great point as well. I think a lot of people remember so much about Borneo, but I think
or they kind of distill it down that Rich won because he was strategic. But, you know, the four votes Rich wins, Sean, Greg, Sue, and Rudy, were four people you wouldn't expect him to win the votes of. Sean and Greg detested the strategy and the cutthroatness of it all. Sue hated his corporate politics, and Rudy didn't really appreciate his lifestyle. So, you know, the idea that he's evolved and grew with these people as time goes on, I think makes it a really satisfying story. And that's why I think it should be worth playing for.
Okay. All right. Let's now go to Mike. Who's next?
Well, listen, you can't have one half of the Toggy Four without the other one. These two are a bit more contentious than the Rich and Rudy dynamic, I would say, specifically how it ended. We are passing by Kelly Wigglesworth and Sue Hawk in the desert, and we are going to give a big drink of water as we talk about how these two ended up having one of the biggest falling outs in Survivor history by the end of Borneo.
Okay. So Kelly and Sue, we have here in our iconic power duos. Interesting. I would not have thought of them as a power couple.
Yeah, so I know that Kevin and Nigel, you guys are the ones that curated this list. Nigel, do you have any thoughts as to why you wanted to go with both halves of the Toggy Four, as it were?
Yeah, you know, I think that it may be easy to think at first dynamic duos, these are just going to be people who are working hand in hand the whole time. But I think it's better to have a higher level view of all of this, where the relationship between Kelly and Sue, I think, is the magic that is Borneo. You know, we see the story essentially told from Sue's eyes, and it is revealed upon her jury speech. You know, it's a speech that is just based off of purely their relationship. It is raw. It's emotional. It is very offensive. It's great television. And, you know, this is a speech that is so iconic. We hear Shireen mention it, you know, 28 seasons after that as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they are iconic. You think of Kelly, I think Sue's the second person you think of, right? They are just so linked in their stories. And, you know, for me, like I said, I want people who have unique situations, complement each other very well. And I think Kelly and Sue certainly are like the tough girls within Toggy, but their relationship was really fun to track. I actually had a friend rewatch Borneo, and he kind of expected this kind of epic betrayal of Sue, right? Because he knew about snakes and rats. And he was like, well, just a tie vote and then just Kelly flop. That's all it was. And I was like, I think it really so much deeper that because Sue valued Kelly so much and kind of saw her as this like childhood friend practically, and that Kelly seemed to not really appreciate or reciprocate that back, was so I think vulnerable and raw that you see something very similar to Brenda and Dawn 13 years later. I mean, yeah. It is the hallmark of relationships.
Mike, I think there's more to that breakup. There's the one episode where it's sort of like they come in like the middle of like Kelly and Sue are yelling at each other.
Yeah, that's at the final five, I think.
Yeah, and or final six. It's just that Sue feels like that Kelly is trying to suck up to Pagong.
Yeah, so I mean, their relationship is also incredibly interesting because for a while there, they were each other's tightest allies, right? Like there was that whole thing with Stacey where she was trying to get something going with the women, and Kelly and Sue said like, oh, this is a great idea. I'm going to copy it and paste it into my own preferential trio with Richard Hatch. But I think that they still were like very solid with each other, especially as, you know, you look at Richard as sort of like a schemer, or Rudy as the nice guy, but not necessarily someone that got on with interpersonally. But as the merge went on and Kelly became increasingly vocal of like, I don't like how we're doing this. That's when Sue began to get resentful, right? Because essentially saying like, well, you're painting me as the enemy for playing the game. When you're doing all the same things, you're taking the cookies out of the jar just like me. My hand's covered in chocolate. Yours are squeaky clean. I don't understand why this is happening. And so while it was a pretty sudden break when Kelly ends up betraying Sue, it was something that, to your point, had been building up a bit, where Sue had been growing resentful of Kelly for trying to shift the blame from the voting that she was doing. And at the same time, I think Kelly was growing like increasingly reliant on Sue for the way that she was taking more so the Richard style of like, it's just a game. We can cut people's throats. It's fine.
Yeah. To go back to Sue Hawk's own words, she says, Kelly, the rafting persona queen, you did get stomped on. on national TV by a city boy that never swam, let alone been in the woods or the jungle or rode a boat in his life. You sucked on that game. Anyway, I was your friend at the beginning of this, really thinking that you were a true friend. I was willing to be sitting there, putting you next to me. And at that same time, you were sweeter than me. I'm not a very openly nice person. I'm just frank, forward, and tell you the way it is. To have you sit there next to me and me lose $900,000 just to stomp on somebody like this. But as the game went along and the two tribes merged, you lied to me, which showed me the true person that you are. You're very two-faced and manipulative to get where you're at anywhere in life. That's why you fail all the time.
Interesting.
There's heat. There's heat there. There's something.
You know, I think that Kevin quotes that speech to me
often
with a lot of enunciation on words that I wouldn't normally enunciate. He likes to emulate Sue's manipulative to the point
manipulative.
That he has forgotten how that word is supposed to be pronounced.
Oh, but no.
He likes to read the speech to me probably more than once a week.
Yeah, and it made me actually conscious of saying that word around other people because I will say it incorrectly. I'm like saying it in my head a billion times so I don't make a mistake. But we did make them team manipulative. Is that right or wrong now?
We also thought of the hawk and the rat.
Okay.
Ooh, I like that as
predator
well.
Predator and prey.
Yeah, I mean, Mother Nature did intend for the hawk to eat the rat as well. Who needs a snake? A hawk can fly. A hawk eats snakes every day of the week.
All right. So here are Kelly and Sue. Mike, where do you want to start the bidding on Kelly and Sue, the hawk and the rat?
I was saying, ain't no hishabah, ain't no hishabah, come on, ain't no hishabah. All right, so I'm going to go with my life is fine for the moment, because here's the thing. There certainly is iconic aspect behind it. It would not have made this list if it wasn't. I think the fact that it built to this fervor to create one of, I mean, I think we... I forget it if you and I ranked it the number one jury speech of all time. I think we ended up doing so.
Of course it is. Yeah, it has to be.
Yeah. So for this to sort of be to lead this dynamic to lead to that incredible speech really has to say something. That being said, I am going back to sort of Nigel's argument now of like outside of that, there aren't too many like Kelly, Sue, Hawk and Rat things that I can necessarily think of from Survivor Borneo. And I can certainly think of more Rich and Ruby stuff between the sunscreen, between the he's fat, but he's good, that type of stuff. I think that's what pushes it a level above Kelly and Sue. So they will, I think, remain a level below their Toggy 4 counterparts.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think Nigel and I are people who talking independently feel that like Sue and Kelly are a better duo than Rich and Rudy. But I know that may be an unpopular opinion overall, because I think just the relationship is so much more intense. I mean, all of the scenes, all of the previews about, will the Toggy Alliance stay together? It's the two of them fighting. There's just a lot of levels to explore. And, you know, when Sue's doing this kind of tearful confessional about how Kelly reminds her of her late friend, it is really moving. And if you remember that detail by the time we get to the finale, I think that speech is even more impactful.
Yeah.
So while I understand that a lot of people would not put them in the same tier, I would personally.
And you know, Mike, I think that your speech about wanting to elevate Rich and Rudy to worth playing for because of a different storytelling style in Borneo, I think that speech really worked on me because I personally would also put them at worth playing for, I think, precisely because of that.
Okay. Well, then let me be the voice of dissension here. I think they should be in Forget You, Go Home, Goodbye.
What?
Because we are ranking iconic Survivor power couples. This is not a power couple. This is a sour couple. If we were going to come up with a list of Survivor's greatest enemies or rivalries, put them at the top of the list. But in terms of a power couple, by the definition, a power couple, two people who function together and become more powerful together than they are apart, how is that Kelly and Sue? That they had a legendary breakup.
Yeah, I mean, look at the first. I mean, are J-Lo and Ben Affleck not a power couple, even though they had a breakup at one point? You have to consider the whole variety of the timeline, not just the ending of it.
Yeah, okay, but that at least they had Geely. What do Kelly and Sue have to show?
Is there Geely?
No, that they had like an epic divorce. Like, you can't say that they're a power couple because they had an epic divorce.
Right, and this is their Kramer versus Kramer, as snakes versus snakes and rats.
So, Yeah, I am not nearly as high as the rest of the group on putting them into power couples. Sour couples.
Yeah, well, sour is a flavor, and it's a powerful flavor. And epic and power, you know, I feel like those are maybe are synonyms. I don't have a thesaurus. But I think they are epic, intense. Their stories are clearly linked. I think of them as a power couple. And that's why I think they should be at least in the top half.
Okay. I realize that I am outvoted here. I feel like that they should. I feel like that. Why don't we keep them in My Life is Fine? At least it's not the tip top tier. My complaint is noted.
Your complaint has been lodged with the team of Mike, Kevin, and Nigel. We will take it into consideration.
Yeah, I'm not looking good for the power throuple right now. Okay.
No, you want that person to spice it up, right? That's the whole Kelly and Sue dynamic. It's because they were so powerful because they had dissension amongst the ranks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just think that while I understand that they might not be a traditional power couple, I feel like that of the people that we're going to talk about today, I think that we're going to talk about very many traditional Survivor power couples that I think you'd want to have ahead of them.
Well, then let's move on to a couple I would say had power. One person certainly thought they were a couple. That person also maybe was thinking about them being a couple in another way as well. If you hear that noise, it's the bellboy knocking on the door. We're talking Colby Donaldson and Jerry Manthe, a dynamic 3 seasons strong from season 2 to 8 to 20. Colby and Jerry from the Outback and beyond.
Okay. All right. Colby and Jerry, Kevin and Nigel, how are they power couple?
You know, Rob, by your previous definition that you went with, looking at Sue and Kelly there, I'm guessing you probably won't be nearly as high on Colby and Jerry. But, you know, looking back to Australia, I think that they are an iconic relationship that is just immensely memorable. You have an incredible dynamic of Jerry believing that they're on a romantic getaway together, if you will, and Colby having no interest in continuing this whatsoever. And it's a relationship that, as you said, Mike, continues on season after season. You made a reference to the bellboy. They reference each other in their voting confessionals when the other goes out. You know, I think that it's hard in my mind not to think of the two of them as inherently connected to each other. What do you think?
I mean, I definitely agree. The bellboy certainly sees them as a relationship. And, you know, that's why we went with them as team baggage. But I really also like the idea, since they went on that reward together, that they also could be the Great Barrier Beef.
Ooh, don't tell Joe Del Campo that.
Yeah. The beef was the barrier for Joe.
But it's a three season story. Yeah. I do think that we don't get that final resolution like we really wanted to, but I think they are iconic. And I mean, two of the most iconic and recognizable survivors of all time that have stories very linked to each other. It's hard not to put them on the list at all.
Okay. I probably like wouldn't have had them if I was kind of just like naming Survivor power couples off the top of my head, but at least they do have 3 seasons together, and they have their moments together. They have like, you know, iconic moments on the show when they are sort of like a flirty. There's also, though, a lot of times when they are not getting along. I do think that their story sort of like comes full circle, where that I think they get along pretty well. I think at the end of Heroes versus Villains, they're sort of on the same page, if not strategically, at least from the standpoint of like their friendship. So to me, it's not an iconic power couple, but at least it's a couple.
Yeah, I mean, it's that couple, right, that like stays together despite like all the virulent arguments they get in with each other. And that's the thing as well, is that their Australia dynamic was like, it was perceived at least that Jerry was massively crushing on Colby. And as Colby will quote in one of our tiers, like, he ain't no Hershey bar. He doesn't want that. He, you know, is the part of the alliance that turns on Amber and Jerry and votes Jerry out. Jerry gets her revenge in season 8. And then in season 20, even though they'd like us to believe that it was Russell Hance and Parvati and like 18 other players, Colby and Jerry apparently were able to make up and let bygones be bygones, certainly after the fact. So I think this is one of the most like tried and true continuous relationships in Survivor history, at least across those first 20 seasons. They only played with each other. They never played any other seasons without the other person. And so I do feel like they are inextricably linked together to have that power coupling association, even though I think like the emphasis is more so on couple than power, because Colby was definitely the more powerful one, especially early on. I think them as a duo is very much part of each other's Survivor journeys.
Okay. All right. Let's look at the board and see what we're going to do here. All right. So here's Colby and Jerry. All right. Where should they go?
What do you think, Kevin?
I would probably put them in My Life is Fine. I just want to make sure, because I feel like Rob has an agenda here.
What's my agenda?
That you're going to try to knock Kelly and Sue down. And I know that technically...
I've said my piece on the Kelly and Sue. I'm ready to move on exclusively to talk about Colby and Jerry.
Yeah, Rob's not manipulative. He's not trying to work Kelly and Sue down to the bottom.
Well, because I think there's a semantic issue here about, you know, are they a power couple? Are, you know, like, how does that work? And to me, you know, maybe Kelly, Sue, Colby, Jerry don't fit that definition as much as like Yul and Becky do, but I'd rather talk about them anyways, you know? So as far as I'm concerned, I think they are My Life is Fine, but I will settle for a no Hershey bar. Nige?
Yeah, I think that I would also place them in My Life is Fine because they are both characters that are truly iconic in the series of Survivor. They are inexplicably always connected with the other. Mike, as you said, they're that couple that probably should have broken up, but for some reason you agreed to go on vacation with them and it's not fun the whole time. I think that they are My Life is Fine.
Oh my God. Imagine sharing a timeshare with Colby and Jara. Chocolate. Off the wazoo. I think if we're talking about them as Survivor characters, it's worth playing for slam dunk. But I do think we knock it due to the fact that, as you said, like they weren't exactly allies that work so tightly together. That sort of the Rich and Rudy and some of these other couples will have. So I feel like that's enough to knock them down at least one rung. I'm happy keeping them in My Life is Fine. I'd probably put them above Kelly and Sue.
Mike, as you said before, ain't no Hershey bar literally is referring to this exact relationship. How are we not putting them in ain't no Hershey bar?
The God, should we do it Mother Nature intended and put Colby and Jerry in ain't no Hershey bar?
Yeah. I mean, Colby talking about his relationship, like, hey, I ain't no Hershey bar. So to me, like, I feel like if the cowboy hat fits, then that's where this should be.
Rob, I think you make a good argument there.
There is no power to this couple. It is like a couple times, but they have no power in the game. What did they accomplish in the game as a power couple? Getting Mad Dog voted out?
And they stole a good amount of coral from the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what they have to do. And they're like Bonnie and Clyde, Rob. They're partners in crime.
I mean, as a duo in the game, they're less accomplished than Kelly and Sue.
That's true.
So
all right, well,
doing Survivor couples, like romantic partners, like I kind of feel like I have them higher. But as far as iconic Survivor power couples, I mean, I do think that one of the criteria should be like, how well did they function in the confines of the Survivor game?
I mean, so are we rooting for synergy there, or are we rooting for dysfunction? Because dysfunction often leads to more entertainment than synergy.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah, I root for dysfunction. And that's why I, you know, I'm okay with ain't no Hershey bar, though I believe they'll likely be the high end of that tier.
Okay. And again, but if these are power couples, again, like I think that they need to have demonstrated, you know, some power, flex some muscle in the game. They can be dysfunctional, but also like that within that dysfunction, hopefully is also some function.
No, yeah. Jerry and Colby were no muscle. They were all organ. Mm-hmm.
Easy. All right.
Well, let's move on to something. We're moving from chocolate on to used mints. Hopefully, Rob, you don't take too much umbrage with this, because this does feel like two people who work together for the entirety of the game. And some people might call them the rich man's Roger and Elizabeth from Colby and Jerry's season. We are talking Pascal and Nalia from Survivor Marquesas.
Yes. Two sweet peas in a pod. Pascal and Leah. Okay. Kevin, tell me about Pascal and Pappy and Sweet Pea.
Yeah, we thought about naming them Team Pappy and Sweet Pea, but I think we just went for Team Judge Mint. Mm-hmm. And we thought you'd like
well
that.
Well done.
And, you know, the two of them are so close. I think there's always a question about, like, who's better, Roger and Elizabeth or Pascal and Nalia? And I think by a country mile, it's Pascal and Nalia, because I feel like Roger and Elizabeth's story feels, it's a little too perfect. Like, the only reason they lost is because Scoopin' fell in the fire and Jeff ate peanut butter, right? Like, it's like, they just lost the numbers. But Pascal and Nalia are, like, really important cogs in the machine. I think the fact that Pascal draws a rock because he can't vote out Nalia and then goes out himself is, you know, pretty epic and fascinating. And the relationship is, like, really pure and sweet. So I think Pascal and Nalia definitely deserve to be on here, and I would put them at a pretty good tier. Nige?
You know, if we're going to talk about Pascal and Nalia, I have to say my piece, and I have to reference the move of sharing a mint from your mouth. I find to be the most egregious thing that anyone has ever done on the show Survivor. I think that I had to pause and rant for like 10 minutes because I could not believe what was before me with passing along a used mint.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What was the part that was so upsetting, Nigel?
All of it. Imagine starving. Imagine being so uncomfortable. Rob, I don't know. You may or may not be aware of some of the things that these survivors go through. But to be told, oh, hey, I brought something for you, and it is a mint that has been sitting in someone's mouth. I also find it to not just be offensive, but it's also, I think, a very bad social move.
Nigel, you have to remember, this was before COVID.
Exactly.
Wasn't as much of a faux pas.
In 2020, of course, you're like, hell no, stay away. But I think pre-2020, you're like, I might consider that for half a second, at least, as opposed to 0 seconds.
I mean, I think Pascal and Nalia are really fun because I think they're like a more like negative toned Roger and Elizabeth. Like I was saying earlier, the idea that like someone is so sweet, they're nauseating, you know, is like Nalia's story, essentially. How do you tell a story of a Survivor sweetheart who doesn't win? I think Colleen and Elizabeth were supposed to be shown as like this like opposition force that we're supposed to root for. And Nalia, who literally actually flips the game, unlike the two of them, loses. And so I think the relationship is really fun, even if it is very cringe with the mint.
Yeah. Mike, you have any thoughts on Pascal and Nalia?
Yeah, I do think if we're comparing them back to Roger and Elizabeth, I do feel like Roger and Elizabeth are the more passive and Pascal and Elizabeth are the more aggressive. And it might just be due to the positions that they're in, right? They are, as mentioned before, key cogs in that fall of the road to four. Them and Kathy were really the ones to help propel things forward and save another power couple in Sean and V in the game. But it's also, I think, another, you know, two people that, much like Rich and Rudy, would never necessarily consort with each other in real life, right? The Georgia judge and the young Mormon girl. I don't see them necessarily at a mixer anytime soon. And so I do think the bond that they were able to make with each other, the fact they were able to find solace with each other when they swapped tribes, and then able to, you know, work together to the bitter end, where Pascal, as you said, like risks life and limb in the game just to make sure that Nalia could possibly stay another day. I think just really shows how deep this relationship would go. And I think the fact that they also were able to wield power together nudges them on this list ahead of someone like Roger and Elizabeth.
Yeah. To me, I still feel like that they're a little bit like the Wish.com version of Roger and Elizabeth, of like what you ordered versus what you got. But to me, I mean, I do feel like that they fit the definition of a power couple in that they did make moves. They were an unbreakable pair in the game. They got themselves both very far, both making it to the top four. So I think that they should be, you know, decently high up on the list.
Yeah, it's interesting. I do think that Pascal might be Bizarro Roger, if you think about it. Like, Roger can't jump in the water. Pascal swims down and carries rocks in the water and wins challenges, you know? Like, they really are oppositional versions of each other.
Just on that alone?
I mean, that's one. I've got that.
Roger had a hat. Pascal didn't.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Pascal had a flag. Roger had no flag.
So, okay. So maybe they truly are opposites. All right. Let's look at the big board. All right, here we go. Pascal and Nalia. All right, Nigel, where do you think? Do you have a starting position for them?
So, you know, when I was looking at these couples trying to determine how exactly were we going to be grading them, something I was keeping in mind was, how unique is the story that's being told between these two? I think, you know, Rich Rudy, Sue Kelly, Colby Jerry, these are all unique stories. But the fact that so much of our conversation has been centered on Roger and Elizabeth, to me, kind of takes away from, I think, the overall score that I would give them. So I personally would say, forget you, go home, goodbye.
Okay.
Wow. Is it because of the mint? Be honest.
Well, the mint is not helping. It's probably like 50-50.
I would put them in Ain't No Hershey Bar just because I do believe that they, you know, fit the definition that Rob desperately wants us to fit. And, you know, they play a really important role in the show, in the show's history. Yeah. And I, you know, I will give respect to the two of them for doing that and always be forever grateful for their contribution. Yeah.
Kevin, call me a stickler if you want, but I feel like that if we have the name of a list, like, I think we should try to find things that fit the name of the list. Sometimes things are different lists that is not this one.
What's in a name?
That's what people want to hear. I think that people are very interested to, like, all right, you said you're going to talk about power couples. What are the power couples?
All right, so from that perspective, I would probably put it in Ain't No Hershey Bar as well, in that I do feel like probably not as strong from an iconic perspective as the other three that we've talked about. But I do think from the power couple perspective, they definitely satisfy that. I could be talked into putting them above Colby and Jerry, but I don't know if I could push them into My Life Is Fine, just due to the, as you said, maybe the copycat sequel version of Roger and Elizabeth of it all.
I think this is fine here. Should they be ahead of Colby and Jerry or behind Colby and Jerry?
I don't know. What do you guys think?
I mean, I think that, as we said, Ain't No Hershey Bar is specific to the relationship that is Colby and Jerry. So I think that for that alone, those two should remain at the top of that category.
So let me throw something else out there. I think that, can you say one of the person's names and not add the word and the other person's name? I think that that should be a big criteria for this list. You do that.
So if we're doing Family Feud and it's like, okay, we pulled 100 Survivor fans. Give me Colby blank.
Yeah.
And say and Jerry. I
think you think of a lot of Colby. I might say Colby and Tina before I said Colby and Jerry. But does anybody say Pascal, which is not immediately followed by Nalia?
That's a good point. It is more associative, but it is also because these are bigger characters that have more involved with it, as opposed to Pascal and Nalia, who were in one season of Survivor, whose characterization was revolving around each other.
Their entire storyline was their relationship.
So what would you want to move it up?
I think
then,
that I wouldn't have them higher than Ain't No Hershey Bar, but I would have them ahead of Colby and Jerry.
I'm fine with that personally. I don't know if we're going to tie it up here with Kevin and Nigel.
Fine. Put them ahead of Colby and Jerry.
Okay. I don't want to bully anybody on the panel about this. I'm just telling you how I feel, and I have passionate takes.
I think that you make a fair point that it is difficult to say either Pascal or Nalia without immediately thinking of the other. So I'll give it to you.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about who's next, Michael.
All right. Well, we took a brief break from chocolate. let's go back and let's throw in some peanut butter for good measure, Rob. We are going to your dear friends, Jenna and Heidi from Survivor the Amazon.
Okay. Yes.
What were they, like sticks and twigs? Was that their nickname?
Who can say, Mike? Who can remember?
Who was there?
I don't recall. Yeah. Yeah, Jenna and Heidi.
Let's hear your immediate reaction. What are your thoughts on
To me personally, like it wasn't like top of mind. If you told me to name the top 10 Survivor power couples, I probably wouldn't have come up with them in my initial pass. But I mean, I feel like that in terms of like duos that function together, basically were complete BFFs throughout the entire game, functioned very effectively together. I feel like that they definitely fit the definition that we're talking about. I think that you do think Jenna and Heidi, that is a duo that, comes instantly to mind. I know that I was very frustrated during the time of Survivor the Amazon I felt like that I was saying to Jenna, hey, I have, if you are a self-interested person, I have a great offer for you. It should be me and you going to the end. And she basically threw that in my face. No way. I'm not doing that without Heidi.
You know, I think it's actually interesting that Rob was they weren't the first, people I thought of as a duo. And I think that it's because probably Rob thought of himself as a pair with Jenna. And certainly based on the editing that we saw, he certainly thought himself as a pair with Heidi for much of the show.
Yeah. I envisioned myself as a couple with either.
He's Jenna? I don't know. What are you talking about?
Sure.
I'm part of this throuple. And I get that. But I mean, Jenna and Heidi, to me, are certainly the first, I think, double downing on a duo. I think the other ones in the past, it's one part this, one part that. But Jenna and Heidi, I think, at least with the editing, are fairly similar. And I do think that takes them away from being the top of the list. But they're certainly, I think, a group that you think of together that function as a unit, whose stories are intricately connected. And we too named them Team Chocolate and Peanut Butter.
Of course,
like chocolate and peanut butter, the older, fatter women have a very complex relationship with them,
But Team Garden and Fruit Teas, if that still exists.
Yeah, they're the younger, cuter women.
I love that. I love that point, though, that rather than sort of being oppositional that we've seen with a lot of these odd couples, this is more so two people that feed into each other. Right. If you're talking with someone who has the same energy as you and you just sort of rile each other up, that's what these two kind of feel like. So it's very different dynamic than what we've seen so far in Survivor.
Two people that complement each other's weaknesses. They're basically
or handicaps.
Same skill sets. Jenna and Heidi. Yeah. I mean, there are certainly differences between the two of them that, if you had spent any time with them that are easy to pinpoint. But on the surface, they do seem very similar.
And if I recall correctly, they do have a joint confessional in the Amazon, correct? Yeah,
that's correct.
And had we seen that up to that point? I don't quite recall.
I don't think so. I think Matt and Alex, I think, also have one, who are not a Survivor power couple by any stretch of the imagination.
It's a good point that they rarely broke form of these are usually times when you're supposed to individually talk to the camera, give your real thoughts, but this other person probably knows what you're going to say anyway. It's they can come. Sure, they can sit down. It's also notable, the first time someone gives up individual immunity is in this season, where Jenna is going to give it to Heidi to keep her safe during that final six vote. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. But also to circle back on the Alex, Matt, Devil, yes, they're not a duo or a couple, but I do think if you include Shauna, they are a throuple. I think that is an iconic triangle.
That was that got awkward. Yeah.
And to the point of the success of the power couple, both of these players make the end game and one of them is our eventual winner. So I think that also speaks to the strength of the power these two had in that game.
Yeah. Okay.
Plus, I will say this is one of those also rare power couples to transcend the show, considering the magazine appearances the two of them make after the fact. And that's another reason why they are linked, why they have that binding, if you will.
Okay. All right. We don't need to get into that any further, Michael. So, yeah, let's look at the board and see where we're at. Okay. Jenna and Heidi.
I mean, I kind of think it's worth playing for. I'm going to be completely honest.
Wow.
I mean, I think these are two who were, they voted in lockstep together, right? They weren't like as much of Rich and Rudy as like they maintained power the entire time in the game. But every time they voted in the majority, they voted together. They never broke from one another, except when it had to come down to the two of them at the final five. I think there are several moments involving the two of them, and specifically the two of them together.
They
and
didn't vote together at the final five?
I don't believe. Yeah, they did. They voted against you at the final five together.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was gonna say that I would have been surprised if they didn't cast the same vote at the final five.
I feel like this is sort of what we went back to with Pascal and Nalia, where I feel like all of their character moments, even when they were on separate tribes, like they were better together than they were separated. And so I feel like those additive properties makes it an iconic Survivor power couple, in my opinion, as odd of a choice as it may be.
Okay.
Yeah. Coming into this, you know, I had actually ranked them at Ain't No Hershey Bar, but talking this out and, you know, the idea of normally we're looking at some two different people coming together, being made better because of their differences, but they're fueling each other's greatness here. So I think I've talked myself into worth playing for.
I mean, I think I would go with My Life Is Fine just because I don't think there's many levels with Jenna and Heidi in the way that there are with some other, I think, duos in Survivor history. But I do think they should certainly be one of the higher ranked people.
Yeah, I think worth playing for is a bit steep for Jenna and Heidi, with all due respect to Jenna and Heidi. And, you know, they have no bigger fans than myself. That being said, I just don't know if, like, when we get done with this, I feel like worth playing for should be like the royalty of Survivor power couples. And with all due respect to Jenna and Heidi, I just don't think that they are an all-time Survivor power couple.
I mean, listen, I'm fine settling for My Life Is Fine, though I think I would put them above Sue and Kelly.
Well, no argument from me on that.
That's fine. We can put them above Sue and Kelly.
Okay. All right. So they are heading up the My Life Is Fine. Going to take a quick break from the list. We've still got a lot more to come. Check the runtime. This is the longest episode of Outwit Outplayout list that we have done to date. Let me thank our sponsors. First, I want to thank our friends over at Theragun, makers of the Theragun Gen 4. Look, if you are not in a power couple, you do not have somebody nearby to help you when you have those sore, aching muscles, Theragun is for you. Whether you're an elite athlete or someone like me just trying to make through the day tension-free, the Theragun can help. Theragun, it's the handheld percussive therapy device that releases your deepest muscle tension using scientifically calibrated combinations of depth, speed, and power, and it's as quiet as an electric toothbrush. The Gen 4 Theragun doesn't just feel good, it goes to the source of your pain by releasing tension using Theragun's signature percussive therapy, which goes 60% deeper than vibration alone. Whether you want to treat your muscle tension from working out, or you have an injury, or just the stresses of everyday life, there's no substitute for the Theragun Gen 4. The OLED screen and design make you feel like you're holding something from the future. Just go to their site and check it out. And the Theragun app learns from your behaviors and suggests guided routines. We are big believers of the Theragun in this house. If you have a sore neck from staring at computer screens all the time, like I do, or if you have sore muscles, like especially in those hamstrings, you are going to love the Theragun. It gets to the heart of the problem. It is trusted by 250 professional sports teams like the Real Madrid and elite athletes like Paul George, DeAndre Hopkins, Maria Sharapova, hundreds of thousands of customers, and me right at this moment. Try Theragun for 30 days, starting at only $199. It gets in there. Get to Theragun.com/RHAP right now and get your Gen 4 Theragun today. That's Theragun.com/RHAP. Theragun.com/RHAP. And now that I'm nice and relaxed, I could tell you about Osea, makers of Undaria algae body oil. Look, we've been all huddled up indoors for all this time. Your skin can get all dry. We're huddling up all winter. That's why your skin needs some TLC. And just in time, here comes Osea to help get things nice and healthy and smooth. I got the chance to try out some of Osea's Undaria algae oil. Nicole also got her hands on it as well, taking it away from me. Osea's Undaria algae body oil instantly moisturizes and replenishes dry skin, leaving every inch silky smooth. Your skin is going to be super soft and glowing with Undaria algae, acai pulp, and babassu seed oil. That's the same stuff that we had in the Amazon, and you don't have to go all the way to Manaus to get it. Osea soaks hand-harvested Undaria algae in barrels of oil for up to 6 months. The result is liquid gold, a rich, luxurious, never-greasy body oil, fragrant with sunny citrus and top notes of sweet passion fruit. Osea creates skin and body care products powered by the sea, responsibly sourced plant-driven ingredients, good for your skin and for the planet. You can try Osea risk-free for 30 days and get free shipping on orders of over $50. They even send free samples with every order. And get 10% off your first order with my promo code RHAP at OseaMalibu.com. That's 10% off with code RHAP at OseaMalibu. That's OseaMalibu.com. That's 10% off with promo code RHAP at OseaMalibu.com. Now, let's get back to the list. Mike.
Rob.
What's next?
Yeah, you mentioned Survivor royalty. Let's talk about a guy who has a bust of his own dang face. We're talking, of course, about Romber, Boston Rob, and Amber. Kevin, you don't even need to come up with an Amazing Race team name, because they are an Amazing Race team twice over at this point.
Yeah, there you go. Rob and Amber, boy, we're going to back-to-back tribe mates for yours truly.
Yeah. Yeah,
Rob, believe it or not.
You're Cupid right now.
Yes, yes. Once upon a time, I said Rob and Amber are going to do it, and called my shot on that one. You heard it here first.
Yeah, four kids, a finals appearance, and then a Winners of War appearance later. Here we are. I mean, this was monumental. Not only did these two determine...
Because Rob got a monument.
Exactly, quite literally.
Yes.
Not only did these two determine the entire course of Survivor All-Stars, much to your chagrin, Rob, but, you know, their performance would end up being, especially from Boston Rob, I think would earn a bunch of different callbacks for him that would sort of cement his place in Survivor history. And they were like Survivor's really first true romantic couple, right? There was some stuff about Greg and Colleen. We spoke about Colby and Jerry, but to your point, like, there was actual schmoopiness between the two of them on the island.
Is that what you want to call it? Should I have said that?
That's my PG version.
Rob and Amber, there's going to be actual schmoopiness coming up. Watch for it.
Look out for the whoopee, kids. Mm-hmm. And so I do think, to the point where it culminates in a reunion proposal before the winner is revealed, if that's not iconic, I don't know what it is.
Yeah. All right. Kevin and Nigel, is there anything you could tell us as to why Rob and Amber shouldn't immediately be moved to the top spot?
I mean, of course not. You know, we've already referenced the fact that they've appeared on outside CBS shows, right? Well, we nicknamed them the Royal Wedding because their wedding was televised by CBS. You know, I mean, how many outside appearances beyond All-Stars do these two have together on television? You know, Amber is actually my favorite Survivor player of all time. And so,
oh my God, that's so good. Is,
you can call it a hot take. But, you know, I like to say that she's the most successful Survivor player of all time because she won. And then she got the husband who kept playing. He even is out there in Island of the Idol. So he's getting a CBS check for that as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's really hard to argue against the fact that.
He has a cookbook. Yeah.
It's just hard to argue against the fact that they are, you know, at this point in our list, you're the most iconic couple.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to go against Rob and Amber as present company.
Believe me. Yeah, I know.
But, you know, how are they not? And they likely will be number one at the end of the day as well. You know, I think on The Amazing Race, we saw other aspects of their personality, too. And so, you know, and the fact that they were just so dominant. I also like thinking of them as Team Romber Rousey. It's just so fun and stupid, right? Just like All Stars. And I mean,
hey, it was not fun.
Going on a cruise is fun.
Yeah.
Are an iconic couple. And, you know, Nigel, I think, really likes Amber and identifies with her because his body is also slamming. And, you know, it's just, that's how can you not root for them? I mean, not root for them, but how can you not see how iconic they really are?
Yeah. I mean, it'd be very hard to make the case. Not the most Survivor, iconic Survivor power couple, Rob and Amber. So, yeah.
They're the gold standard for Survivor relationships, I would say, both romantic and platonic.
Yeah.
Like everyone is looking for their Boston Rob. Everyone's looking for their Amber. So the point where we have had so many facsimiles after the fact that when you go back to the originator of the DNA from which we've cloned so many couples really is a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
And I think the other aspect of this is that they really do represent two sides of the same whole.
How so?
Well, I think, you know, the whole debate that happened right after All Stars, right? You know, was Amber a deserving winner or not? The social game under the radar versus this kind of over the top, more dominant, cutthroat, competitive person. I think it created a whole discourse in the community as well. I mean, that is just how iconic they really are beyond just their love story. I have a question for both of you. It's like, in your relationships, do you find yourself more of the Rob or the Amber?
Amber, by far. Mostly because I have such like a big ecstatic reaction whenever I eat food that it actually is very comparable to Amber Berkovich's. Like I am often saying like, oh, this is great. Oh, I love this. Oh, boy. Oh, baby.
Yeah. I would say like in different areas, I think that sometimes one of us is more of the Rob and one of us is more of the Amber. So I feel like that probably like even in Rob and Amber's own relationship, they probably have this where there are things that like, okay, Amber is 100% in charge of and Rob just doesn't care about. And I think the secret to a happy relationship is sort of like, okay, knowing, okay, this is your thing. I have like no stakes in this. You take that and I'll work on this other thing.
We don't know what that's like because we're in together so much. We're more Jenna and Heidi, I think, at that.
Yeah, I get that. I get that.
Yeah, like just showering each other.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right, Rob and Amber, top spot. Let's see if anybody can dethrone them.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they're sitting on the schmoopy chair for the time being, at least.
Yeah, certainly. I don't think there's going to be a romantic duo that's going to knock them out of the top spot. But let's see how the rest of the list goes. All right. What's next?
All right. So we're going to go a couple seasons from now. And, you know, this couple is not necessarily romantic. I would call them more so epic. We're talking Tom and Ian. From Survivor Palau, these two guys are sort of seen as sort of like the dual leaders of the Korora tribe, right? In the hard-fought battle that was Survivor Palau, they attempt to take shots at each other at the very end. But really, I would say the story of the season outside of Stephanie LaGrosa's crusade on Oolong is Tom and Ian, you know, first them working together and being targeted and then eventually turning on each other and then Ian quitting the game to give Tom the win. It's just it's all about Tom and Ian, Survivor Palau.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Kevin, what are your thoughts on Tom and Ian and what are their nicknames?
I think we went with, you know, the dolphin and the shark. It's kind of an obvious thing. It didn't make us think who Katie is, but we're not sure, but we definitely think Karen's the sea urchin. And so, you know, we can have like an aquatic theme for all of Karor.
Watch out, John Carroll.
But Tom and Ian, I think a really intense relationship, as we see their ups and downs, very father and son. And you know, we mentioned that Aris and Terry are not on this list, but it certainly feels like that level of intensity, this rivalry between them. But they certainly have a much more pleasant relationship during most of the game than Terry and Aris do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that a big reason why you would want to have these two on the list is because of the way that their story culminates in that challenge on the buoys that goes on for hours and hours and hours. But I think that for me, something that does take away a little bit from how I will ultimately rank these two is the fact that I often think of Tom and Ian with Katie as well, you know, but ultimately the season does come down to that battle between the two of them. I think that the story is kind of told from the perspective of leading to that moment. So while I do really appreciate that aspect, I do think that they are harmed a little bit by the fact that they, I think, are a little more iconically part of a throuple than just a couple.
Okay.
It's an interesting point. I mean, I've just been thinking this over, and spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about Wendell and Dominic much more down the line, but it's made me realize, were Tom and Ian the proto Dominic and Wendell? Go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say, no, I don't think so, because the Dominic and Wendell relationship I think that's a different dynamic than Tom and Ian, where Dominic and Wendell were brothers. Dominic and Wendell were like best friends on the island. Tom and Ian are father and son on the island. So yeah. I just think that the difference in age changes that dynamic, where I think that Wendell could have said anything to Dominic. Dominic could have said anything to Wendell. But I think that just like because of the age difference, I think there was a clear sort of like, okay, Tom is the alpha and Ian is sort of like the second in command there, that there was no way that, you know, Ian was like usurping the leadership from Tom.
Yeah, and that's a good point that they really were brothers. And as we know, when you're the sibling, the really interesting thing about it is neither one of you is the parent. So that's why Tom and Ian have a really different yes. type of dynamic. It's a good point. I think, yeah, from that relationship perspective, I guess I was more so sketching it out in terms of like the storylines themselves. And then yeah. here you have, in both cases, two pairs who work really tightly together, and then at the very end are like, maybe I should turn on this other person. With Dominic and Wendell, for a various variety of reasons, it doesn't end up working out. With Tom and Ian, it sort of does, right? Like, Tom votes to vote out Ian at the final four, and then Ian essentially sacrifices his position at the final two, where for all we knew, he might have been facing off, you know, against Tom in a different yeah. universe.
But just... I really like the way that you set that up, and then we got into this conversation, because I feel like that of the people that we've talked about, I don't think we really have a father and son type relationship. Rudy and Rich, there is a big age difference there, but I don't think that that feels like a father and son. But Tom and Ian more so does.
Yeah, I mean, to the point where like the son, like the dad being like, I'm disappointed in you, just like totally crushes Ian in a way. Mm-hmm. I know there are a lot of people who are very critical, I think, of how Tom and Ian, like how that story kind of ended, or how like maybe that Tom was a bit underhanded in that. But I've always thought their relationship, like I said, has lots of levels, is very fascinating. And, you know, are they an iconic Survivor power couple? As Karen would say, definitely. You know, it's just it's obvious.
Yeah. By the way, if anybody wants more on Tom and Ian and Katie, we had a great trilogy of podcasts during the summer of 2020. First with Tom, then with Ian, then with Katie, all on Talking with T-Bird. And if you ever go to any of the Talking with T-Bird posts, there are links to all the past Talking with T-Bird episodes if you want to check those out. All right, but let's look at them on the board here. Here we go. Tom and Ian. All right. Very effective as a duo. Yeah. Mike, where do you think they should start?
Yeah, this is such a weird one. Like, for the first time, this is one that does not necessarily jump out at me as a ranking, like a killer shark. Because, yeah, they were really effective as a duo, and they had such big moments. I'm tempted to say My Life Is Fine, because I do think that Jenna and Heidi and Sue and Kelly had, like, bigger moments. But these two, I think, more so maybe fulfilled the idea of a power couple. Mm-hmm. And also had the big downfall to boot that we talked about with Kelly and Sue.
Okay. Do you have a preference as to what spot in between on a scale of Jenna and Heidi to Kelly and Sue?
The gradient by which we should all grade all the pieces of Survivor criteria. I might make it a Tom and Ian sandwich here. I might put them in the middle, where I think, you know, Sue and they have more memorable moments than Sue and Kelly, but I do think they're maybe less linked together than, yes, Jenna and Heidi, to Nigel's point.
Okay. Nigel, how are you feeling about this?
You know, I think that I could be convinced of ranking them anywhere from My Life Is Fine to Forget You, Go Home, Goodbye.
Wow.
I think it kind of comes down to what ultimately you value. And I think that for me, you know, I always think of Katie when I hear their two names. And when we're talking about, do you automatically link the other person to them? For me, I think that that lowers my ranking of the two of them. But I understand why you would want to rank them higher.
Yeah, I think they're really good in My Life Is Fine. I think you can put them above or below Jenna and Heidi, just because I do think that the finale is because of Tom and Ian. They really, I think, pick up that story once Stephanie leaves, and they keep Palau, I think, really turning everything out until the very, very end.
Mm-hmm. I think it's good where Mike has it, that I feel like that the argument that Nigel made about Katie being a very real part of this triangle, I think that is a very good one. I do think that they are more effective and thought of together as a duo than Kelly and Sue are. But as far as Jenna and Heidi goes, once upon a time, I opined that they shared a brain in the game of Survivor. Jenna was willing to give up her spot in the game to Heidi, and so just think that they were more effective as one unit than Tom and Ian were.
All right, so let's move on then. So look, if Jerry and Colby are the two couples, or the one couple that keep getting together and breaking up, getting together and breaking up, this next couple is the one having a loud argument in the shitty little apartment above you at 3 a.m. that you're debating if you want to call the cops on them. We are going to Survivor Exile Island. We are talking about Shane Powers and Courtney Merritt.
Now, I think that these two are probably maybe leaning a little bit more towards iconic than they are powerful. But I think that, you know, Shane and Courtney have some pretty explosive moments on the show. As you stated, Mike, we get to discuss Courtney's shitty apartment. And, you know, when Shane threatens to go there to murder her, Courtney's immediate reaction is to verify that her apartment's not actually shitty. That's like the most important thing to her.
After he says, I'm going to come and kill you in your shitty little apartment, that's the part of the sentence that she makes an effort to correct.
Mm-hmm. Look, as someone who has been threatened to be murdered by Shane Powers on more than one occasion, that's a term of endearment for Shane. He doesn't mean it. I don't think he's ever even murdered anybody. I have been with him. I don't have his whereabouts
Where's Courtney Merritt? Has she been, made an appearance lately?
She's
the real question.
Fire dancing in the afterlife now.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Kevin, you have any additional thoughts on Courtney and Shane?
I mean, I think, you know, to me, Courtney and Shane, you think of one, I do think of the other, right? Because of that dynamic, that 3-2-1 vote, even though they don't vote together, the fact that they kind of saw each other as goats to take to the end because of the situation they're in, the fact that they're both very sensitive about the challenge Suri won. They're explosive and combustive, and that's why, since he's a smoker and she's a fire dancer, we named them Team Where There's Smoke, There's Fire.
That's good.
I like that.
And it's just, you know, it's just it's very thrilling and exciting. And I always remember that this duo was there to make the Bruce Medivac one of the most fascinating of all time. Mm-hmm. So I have to, you know, tip my cap.
Yeah. Yeah. The stars were truly aligned that of all the people to be stranded with Bruce and to help him through his incredibly painful constipation, it is Courtney, who is singing songs in his ear, and Shane, who is buck-ass naked as he picks up the stretcher to take Bruce away. Like, of all people, these are the bottom two of any people you want to be handling any extreme medical situation. And here they are.
All right.
And it's actually not just Courtney singing to him. It's Courtney singing to him after he's asked her to stop. It's even better.
Okay.
This is not a couple. This is not a couple. That they were on Survivor, but they had no power, and they were not a couple. So they were a good rivals. They had memorable exchanges. But
now, are they rivals, though, if they were working together?
I mean, like, to me, like, well, let's look at the board.
They had a final two deal. They had a final two deal. That's like
so did a million people.
Yeah, but this one was exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you could put this ahead of anybody that's on the list.
I mean, I agree. I think that this is the bottom right now, which I love. It's very fitting that I think Shane and Courtney are sitting on the thinking stuff right now. I forget you, go home, goodbye. I think they are an incredible dynamic. And I do think of the people from this just absolutely chaotic Kasaya alliance. These are the two that I think of specifically together. Like, Danielle might be the Katie in this equation, right? Like, the third person thrown in. But I feel like more people think of the specific personalities of Shane and Courtney clashing with each other. That's another thing as well, right? There's a bit of an odd couple dynamic of, like, here is this very irascible, detoxing man and this very, like, footloose and fancy free fire dancer building a zen garden in the middle of camp, that they're, like, so alike with some of the things they pursue, get so different at the same time. It's very poetic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like literally the worst roommates you could have in LA, I feel like. I mean, it's this intensity about them.
Yeah.
I think it's very fitting for them to be in the fourth tier, and I will accept that. I think it should be important to know that there were so many couples that could have been on this list, and so many of them would go on tiers far below Shane and Courtney, but I do think that it's fine to put them here.
Okay. All right. Nigel, are you okay with that?
Oh, I don't think that you can place them anywhere else except for the very
forget you, go home, goodbye.
Go home, goodbye. But that's what makes their relationship.
Yes.
I'm going to say beautiful with air quotes.
Yeah,
it feels like a quote they would say to each other. And maybe that's how we should also think about where they all go.
Should we rename the tier forget you, go home, and I'll kill you?
Or forget you, go to your not great home. Okay. All right. Let's then check back in with the list. Mike, what's next?
All right, we're skipping a bit far ahead. I know we didn't mention Ceri, but we're actually going to go to her next season, and actually two people that Ceri played with incredibly closely. In fact, the two people that finished ahead of her in Survivor Micronesia, we are talking about two members of the infamous Black Widow Brigade, another storyline that spans multiple seasons. Amanda Kimmel and Parvati Shallow.
Okay, this one is interesting. Okay. Kevin and Nigel, who has the stronger take on Parvati and Amanda?
I think I do. I remember when Micronesia's cast came out and everyone's like, why is it Amanda and Parvati? You know, where is PG or Courtney or Candace? You know, why are these two? And the idea that these two mattresses came on a season called Fans versus Favorites and literally slayed all of our faves to make it to the final two is kind of epic in its own right. And the idea that they kind of eclipsed the legends of people like Eliza and Amy, who were certainly more shoo-ins by the time 16 was coming around, is ironic and fascinating and incredible. And the fact that they have a chapter two when they get to Heroes versus Villains, I think really adds to the depth of their story. Definitely a high ranking power couple as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And, touching on the fact that their story does span multiple seasons. You know, their story actually goes beyond Survivor. That's why we named this couple Into the Blue 2, The Reef. For those of you who are not familiar, they have like a 2-minute appearance in this, what I assume is a bad movie, where they play beach volleyball. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's actually a pretty fun scene because they're actually kind of true to form to their Survivor edits where Parvati is like CPN and Amanda's UTRP. You know, so there's something really beautiful about that consistency there.
Does the man just stare doe-eyed at the ball as it falls into the sand?
Do they have a line? Do they have dialogue?
They do have dialogue. It's not insightful and there's not a lot.
Okay.
But they do have some dialogue.
All right. Not unlike Amanda's Final Tribal Council. I'm teasing. All right. But this is a good pair to have on the list. Would you say that does this pair, Mike, come under the same idea of, I feel like that we're coming up with, as we're doing this, sort of like the different archetypes of Survivor duos. Are they like a Jenna and Heidi, where are they two people who complement each other's strengths?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it sort of is like the Jenna and Heidi compared with the ending of Tom and Ian, where it's like, okay, in Micronesia specifically, you know, they're part of this double date alliance, but they're really loyal to each other, despite, you know, Amanda being left out of the Aussie vote. Parvati is going to bring her back into the fold. They're the only two that are really in on the plan at the final six. Right when Amanda finds the idol, she confides in Parvati, which is very comparable to Jenna giving her immunity away to Heidi. They sort of like have this immune secret between them. And, you know, this is one of the only duos we've experienced so far besides Rob and Amber to be the final two people left in the game, which I feel like says something as well. When a duo sits at the end, I feel like that has to bump up their iconicness by at least a little bit.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if I was going to compare Jen and Heidi to Parvati and Amanda and who is who, that I almost feel like, it's hard to say that I'm tempted to say.
I think Heidi's the Parvati, just because their names both end in I's, but I don't know. I just see that comparison.
Yeah, I think I would say that a little bit more. I just don't know Amanda well at all to be able.
And Amanda and Jenna both end in A's, so I think the letters that are settles leading us to it. A certain path.
Yeah. Okay.
They both do well at the last challenges. And I do think like Amanda is a bit more like Jenna is more like edgy Amanda almost. Like if Jenna was raised in Montana, it would be Amanda. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're a really good team. I do think they're very similar to Jenna and Heidi. I think their story is technically more epic because they are the final two and they do have a second season. I will say that the only thing you really could dock them for is that they do tend to have a lot of other relationships you could pair them with. Like Amanda in particular, you could put her with Parvati.
Yeah.
You could put her with James.
Certainly.
You could put her with Ozzy. Even Ozzy, maybe even Suri. I think this is really just tells you that Amanda is such a beta that she's almost going to be part of a pairing no matter what. Yeah. And it's why she does so well in Survivor.
Okay. Amanda's really the Mike Bloom of Survivor.
Then... Also, are we looking at Suri here as like the Katie to Tom and Ian, where is she a third partner of this?
I think that you have to at least take it into consideration, especially when you remember that they were not necessarily expecting to have a final two at the end of Micronesia. So it's almost sprung upon them at the end that they have to have a duo instead of a trio going into it. But I think that because you do get a second storyline on a second season for the two of them, that does, I think, solidify them as a duo. Whereas Tom and Ian don't have that opportunity.
Yeah,
it's a good point. Yeah. I think what also helps separate that Suri is that Suri's voted out early in Heroes versus Villains, right? Before Parvati's even able to make her way over. So that when we finally get these two reuniting, Suri's not around. And so we have separate Parvati and Amanda moments from Suri moments.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you can't deny this because, I mean, Amanda's lie to Parvati is what triggers the double idol play, which is considered one of the most epic moments in Survivor history. This is definitely worth playing for as far as I'm concerned.
Wow, okay. So I was going to say, to look at the board. All right, you go top tier already.
Yeah, two cusp, you know, favorites coming in and then like locking down a three-time becoming three-time players in a very short span of time. Not even Boston Rob played, I think, three times that sequentially. I mean, they really just transformed, I think, a whole archetype for the show. I mean, how many people were naming themselves like the next Parvati? How many times was Amanda kind of being referenced in Survivor circles? I mean, it's a really epic pairing for two people who did not have a really epic reputation to begin with. So I think there's something really beautiful about that.
Mike, how do you feel?
It's tough because I absolutely am buying Kevin's argument here, but I feel like, to your point, there's just something that separates from me Romber and Rudy and the Nudie from Into the Blue too. It just feels like outside of that idol moment, there aren't like too many big moments that I can associate with these two on the same scale as maybe those other two power couples. I would be fine putting them at the top of my life is fine. But right now, I'm not sure if there's anything particular that's like driving me to put it in the same ballpark. Maybe it's because to Nigel's point, like how much we associate Parvati and Amanda with other Survivor players, whereas opposed to like Rich and Rudy and Rob and Amber, I feel like those are each other's number one from notoriety's perspective, no matter what.
Okay, Nigel, how do you feel about this?
Yeah, I think that you make a good point there, Mike. I think that between Rudy and Rich and Heidi and Jenna is the correct placement for these two because, you know, they both make it to the final two. Heidi and Jenna do not.
Yeah.
These two come back for an additional season and have a storyline together. Heidi and Jenna do not. So I think that, you know, for now, at least at the top of my life is fine is probably the best spot.
I think that that's very well reasoned and I feel like I agree with that spot. Okay.
All right.
Kevin, objections with it not being in the top tier?
I think this is a good spot and I reserve the right to challenge it later.
Okay. All right. Save your challenges for the end. Okay. All right. Mike, what's next?
All right. We're actually only jumping one season ahead. Rob, you talked about this dynamic duo as recently as last week. We are going blazing speed into Survivor Gabon as we are talking about Crystal and Kenny.
Yes.
They made their way long three times over. And now they are here on Outwit, Outplay, Outlist.
Okay. Kevin and Nigel are cheering. Nigel, what are the cheers for?
I mean, I think that when I'm thinking of iconic Survivor duos, these two immediately come to mind. They are very different people from very different walks of life. Again, you would not assume that these two are hanging out at home in their natural lives. They come together and make amazing television. So what's not to love about that? We had two nicknames for these teams, or for these two, I should say, that we had a hard time choosing between. We thought of Pinky and the Brain, and it's not that one is necessarily smarter than the other, but it feels like they're always scheming. They always have harebrained schemes that are so over the top and ridiculous, and they start every episode being like, how can we take over the world today? Mm-hmm. And I root for it every single time. And then the other one we thought of was Smash and Ditch.
Yeah, I like that one.
Ooh, I like that one a lot.
Yeah. I mean, they're really great. You know, I was thinking about this earlier today with Crystal and Kenny, because I've always loved Crystal and Kenny a lot. I really loved Survivor Gabon, and I was very upset that it was taken out so early, in my opinion, in the rank down. But like, when I think about Survivor, what drew me to it is this idea of the social experiment, right? This idea that all these Americans from different walks of life are coming together to build a society, and they'll have to survive the elements and each other in the pursuit of $1 million. I mean, just even saying that kind of like gives me goosebumps, because I obviously love this show. And you don't get any more two different walks of life than Kenny and Crystal, right? These are people who come from different parts of the country, different career fields, different personalities, literal different body proportions. I mean, they are so different from one another. And I think I would be like remiss to not even mention their differences with race and gender, which we know are important things in our society. They're important things in the game of Survivor. And, you know, Crystal and Kenny are the only two people we've talked about thus far who are non-white as a pairing. I think that's a really important thing to mention. Yeah. And you think of the 40 seasons of Survivor, you know, pairs of like of a mixed race, mixed gender, platonic relationship is pretty rare. I mean, most people of color don't tend to excel in Survivor because of a various social reasons. And these two found each other, and it was really exciting. I mean, trying to think about people who kind of fit that mold, I think the closest ones with that same level of visibility is probably like Jeremy and Natalie and Brenda and Sash. And even if you compare it to them, you know, Crystal and Kenny are unique because it is a Black woman and an Asian man. And they represent like groups that are probably the arguably the least assimilated into American society. I don't know. I doubt most people know this, but, you know, I have a background in sociology, and the gold standard for social assimilation is intermarriage, right? If you want community, if you feel comfortable with the community, you're comfortable with them marrying into your family. And Black women intermarry at half the rate of Black men, and Asian women intermarry 50% more often than Asian men. So, you know, Black women and Asian men are some of the least assimilated, the least accepted in our society. And the fact that these two people ended up working together is pretty exciting. There isn't a lot of mainstream representation of Black women and Asian male pairings. I mean, think of today's media, let alone over 10 years ago. That's not happening either. And so for me, I remember being, you know, a teenager watching this and really rooting for these two people because, you know, it would have been very easy for a scripted show to write two characters from underrepresented communities coming together and having a very enthralling story. But this happened in an organic way in a competitive reality show. You know, I mean, thinking about that, that is really incredible. And I and millions of other people got to watch a Black woman and an Asian man not just work together, but literally dominate a game that is supposedly a microcosm of our own society. And they did that. They knocked out huge threats. They overcame a numeric deficit. They were taking out elitist yuppies left and right, and they were duped in the 11th hour because they weren't humble or something. I mean, this is really an exciting couple, and I've talked a lot about them, and I could talk another 4 hours about them. I love Kenny and Crystal.
Okay.
Number one, as far as I'm concerned, but I recognize that's a hot take.
All right. Great points all around.
Seriously.
I talked to Kenny and Crystal most recently last week. My one knock against Kenny and Crystal on the show was that I feel like that they work together well as a relationship. We almost got nothing about the relationship. They very rarely, and this may come to them being under-edited on the show, I feel like that while we have so many different confessionals from like you know, the Rich and Rudies of the world of like, hey, look, isn't this a relationship? JT and Steven also like, hey, I can't believe I'm a city guy and I'm friends with a country person. There's almost no commentary from themselves about like their relationship together.
It's a good point. And I do wonder if part of that is that, and because I'd like to imagine they talked about it, because as Kevin points out, they come from such different walks of life. Crystal, a track star. Kenny, I don't know if he's ever stepped a foot outside in his life. Like, to have them work together in this setting is really, really incredible. I wish we had seen it.
Yeah.
You know, because I would have loved to hear them comment about it. It's a great point that for some reason, like despite them working so well together, for one reason or another, maybe it's because they had something sugar related to do in another scene, they didn't really focus necessarily on like, hey, it's cool that these two people are working together, considering to Kevin's very many good points. Like, it's very, very rare for this to happen.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of show and not tell.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely what's happening here, because to me, what I love about Kenny and Crystal is that they may not like be super like lovey-dovey, you know, in a platonic way even, and the way they talk about how much they mean something to each other, like JT and Steven would. But like, they both save each other. Right. They take out people who are targeting their allies. When Crystal goes to Coda and Marcus gives her an in, essentially, because he knows her cousin, she kind of turns to the camera and essentially says, you're going after my number one ally. I am not pleased, and flips the game effectively, taking out these really big strategic threats to save these people, this person they really care about and want to work with. Even though we don't get a lot of the frills about what they really mean to each other, we recognize they are a unit. And they both stick each other's neck out for each other all the time. And I think that's really incredible to watch.
Okay. All right. Let's look at the board. Here we go. And let's see. Kenny and Crystal. So I don't. Nigel opened up the. I'm sorry. Kevin opened up the bidding at. Should be number one on the list. Nigel, do you agree?
I don't know that I would put them at number one, but I feel confident that I want them at least at number two on this list. You know, I think that you guys made good points when you mentioned that these two, the relationship between them is not as told in the same way as some of these others here. And I agree with you, Mike. I would like to think that, you know, maybe some of that is just the editing and the way that they chose to tell this story. But, you know, when considering that Survivor is a social experiment, these two come from completely different walks of life. They entertained me the entire time that they were on screen. They had a real hand in shaping the direction that this game took. I think for me, they easily fit into the worth playing for.
Yeah, I mean, if you replaced, you know, another professional video gamer, another track athlete, or you just put these two on different tribes, is Gabon less interesting? And I think it is. Because the two of them just work so well with one another. The way they talk strategy with one another is really exciting. It doesn't feel like one person is just leading the other. There's like no coattail situation. It really does feel like a synergistic combination. And that's why I think they should at least be in worth playing for in the total conversation.
Mike, what do you think?
Well, first off, I mean, again, I'm going to draw some really wild comparisons here. I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, Crystal and Kenny walked so Denise and Malcolm could run in that regard. I'm seeing a lot of similarities between these two, oddly enough, in that they came from kind of cannibalized.
Mike, in fairness, Crystal could have run if she didn't have 10-pound tennis shoes, okay?
That's true. Listen, the shoes make the person in more ways than one. But I do think that both of those pairings, right, that come from sort of like embattled tribes where they sort of were forged in fire, had to work their way up from the bottom. Unfortunately, I think Denise and Malcolm are a little more successful than Crystal and Kenny, who, you know, just because of sugar being sugar, completely turns the game on the two of them. I mean, I'm going to bring things down a bit down to earth slash Eden here. I think it goes in my life is fine. Personally, maybe it's because that there are people on this list who maybe have more of a name notoriety than Crystal and Kenny, who sort of like Tom and Ian are sort of like, unfortunately, one season wonders. I think they are a strong power couple, and I think you both make very salient points. But again, I'll say what I said about Amanda and Parvati. It feels to me that there's not like a je ne sais quoi that sort of puts it in that top tier, the Valhalla, alongside Romber and Rudy and Rich.
Okay. Kevin, I thought that your argument for them was so good. I say let's leave them at the bottom of worth playing for and see how the rest of the list goes.
I like that.
Let's let them spend some time here in the top tier.
All right. You two stay there, eat your rice. We'll get back to you in a few minutes.
Yeah. All right. Mike, what's next?
Well, you invoked their name before. We're going ahead one more season. We're talking about another Final Two iconic duo. So iconic that I remember the summer of 2009, Rob, when they did a photo shoot in People magazine dressed up as the Skipper and Gilligan. We are, of course, talking about JT and Steven.
Oh, my God. The great Steven and JT. Oh, man. Oh, baby. Kevin. What can you tell us about this iconic Survivor power couple? That's so great.
I think you have to be on the list, right? You know, when we were thinking about who we'd want to talk about, I don't know if I want to talk about JT and Steven as much as maybe the average Survivor fan, but undeniably they are a power couple and they're connected. The fact that one's the wizard and one's the warrior through coaches like Anthology, you know, we named them Team Camelot. Though I really also wanted to call them Team Future Flops, in the sense that I'm
Kevin?
That they do return without one another and seem to fumble a lot of advantages throughout the course of the time. And so perhaps when they don't have someone like Coach, who's literally okay with just throwing the game away to two really nice guys, it doesn't excite me as much as a pairing. To me, you know, the season prior, Crystal and Kenny are hustling. I don't think JT and Steven are hustling that much. I just don't feel as moved by them, though I do recognize they represent different points of view. They have a very strong relationship. They're obviously really likable characters, but this is not, it's not worth playing for to me.
Okay. Nigel.
So You look at these two, and I think that they are probably, when you think of a Survivor bromance, these two are the first that you'll think of. Rob, I hope that this doesn't upset you at all. I know that you and Steven are obviously an iconic podcasting duo here. Mm-hmm. But
you know, in fairness, I have many.
You do have many. And yeah. You know, maybe this is a little bit of a knock against Steven. He also has another famous duo here. But you know, to me, I think that part of what makes the duo of Steven and JT special is how successful they were when they played together, and the fact that they were not able to recapture that same success once they separated.
Yeah.
And I think that it made for some entertaining moments when they did separate. But I mean, you know, I think that just goes to show how well they worked together while they were out there. It's an easy story to tell of the country boy and the city boy, you know, one that we're all familiar with. Yeah. Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, especially in the context of does their subsequent failures highlight the power couple relationship?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the discourse, right? It's like, well, Steven and JT can't play well separate. Like, you'd say, oh, that impugns them. But I feel like it only emboldens their relationship of like, they are Voltron. They're only strong when they put their rings together and like become one central unit. When they are scattered to the winds, it's a little more disastrous.
Yeah, so I feel like that by the pure definition of the power couples, that these two are better together than the sum of the parts, where that separately they are both like missing what the other, like where we said, like Jenna and Heidi, they are, you know, feed off, you know, each other's like similar energy, that they have sort of like opposite polarity, Steven and JT. And together they do become one more effective unit. And so that's interesting. Now I feel like that when we compare this to Kenny and Crystal, where we were just talking about like that, we didn't get that story. I wonder if there's also because we have these two guys who are two, you know, straight white men who probably that the production team is like, oh, I identify with what these guys are like, where it's probably harder to tell that story from the perspective of Kenny and Crystal, what it's like to be them.
I mean, I think what you're saying, Rob, is makes perfect sense to me. I think like I said earlier with Crystal and Kenny, it's a lot of show and not tell. I feel like with JT and Steven, it's a lot of tell and not as much show. You know, I don't really recall a lot of them scheming together in a really exciting way, dismantling things together. I mean, the Tyson boot does, you know, from the editing perspective, is kind of like Aaron and Steven talking together even. It's a lot of the, how they're being approached. I just don't find that story as invigorating, even though they are clearly a linked duo. Mike, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, like, it's a little comparable to Rudy and Rich for me in many ways, in that I think optically there may be more of a duo than actually, because again, with Richard, he was very much linked with Sue, and with Steven and JT, they very much worked with Taj up to the final four, right? They were the three Jalapaos that were able to dismantle the Timbira alliance. But I think for various reasons, including the fact that Steven and JT are sitting in the final two, which I think is another reason why we built up their partnership above a Crystal and Kenny as well, is because they ultimately are successful over a couple like Crystal and Kenny. I mean, Token Sheens is sort of their story, right? That we get so much of them that, much like Tom and Ian, their relationship is so integral. It also creates maybe the most contentious final tribal council we've had so far. We're again in almost like a Kelly and Sue format. JT takes Steven, hucks him under like an entire bus depot and just runs him over.
So does that count as points against the power couple?
No, I think four, because that's dynamic to me. Much like I think we propped up Kelly and Sue as like, oh, it's great because we have the rise and fall. We sort of have that here with Steven and JT. Granted, the fall happens at quite literally the 11th hour, but it's still there where it's like these two work tirelessly to get to the end, even though, you know, Steven sort of has to be there with JT, but grudgingly so. And then it ends with JT just, you know, really, unfortunately, giving it to Steven over and over again.
Yeah.
I think is a really interesting dynamic to their relationship.
All right. Let's look at the board. Steven and JT. What do we do with these two kooky guys? Okay. So We're probably going to start high, right? I know Kevin doesn't love them. Nigel, where do we start?
So, you know, when I'm thinking about them, I think that what would take them down a bit in my personal ranking is that I think that they are both, I guess you could call them archetypes that are not as rare on this show. I think that, Rob, you know, you've already pointed to Wendell and Dominic as brothers while they were out there. And I'd argue that Steven and JT kind of have that dynamic as well. Yeah. So, you know, while I don't think that their relationship is as unique as some of the others on here, the fact that they were so successful and the fact that they are so iconic, they do not do as well when they're not together. I think that I would place them in My Life is Fine. I'm up for debate on where in there I could place them.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I don't want them higher than Parvati and Amanda. I think you could make a case for them to be similar to Jenna and Heidi because they're both one season long stories that do have a certain amount of levels to it. But I found myself a little, I think, tired by the Country Mouse, City Mouse story that just kept...
Comes up a lot.
Yeah,
comes
up a lot. A lot. They're mice. I don't care.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mike, I do think conventionally Steven and JT get brought up as perhaps, if not after Rob and Amber, one of the best Survivor power couples.
Yeah, I mean, I was coming here wanting to put them in Worth Playing For, and I didn't realize that I would be the highest of the bunch out of us. I absolutely see the points with, like, you know, especially in retrospect, are they bringing anything incredibly exciting, electric, and new to the table? No. But I think if we're sort of looking back on, like, Rich and Rudy as example of, like, oh, this shows what, you know, Survivor can do in terms of from a character perspective with the power couples, I feel like this shows from both a character and a strategic perspective what it can be. The fact that 19 seasons later, Nick Wilson says, I need to find the Steven to my JT. To me, you know, I think name dropping is something that should also put it in the upper echelon. I do think this is one of the iconic Survivor power couples. Even if they are as white as the rice that they are eating, I do think that their legacy and the roles they play in the season, as well as to each other's legacies, is incredibly, incredibly good.
Yeah, I think that the Parvati and Amanda comparison is interesting because that, again, just like Parvati and Amanda, we have a winner and we have a runner-up who work together. It is... I think that I'd have them at the bottom of Worth Playing For.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah. I know you are, Mike, but I wanted Kevin and Nigel to be on board because I don't want to just railroad Kevin and Nigel after they made great points. I just feel like that if my mentions on Friday morning are, how could you not put Steven in Worth Playing For? And then Steven chimes in. That's gonna, like, my head's going to explode.
You know, yeah. I think if you just look at the way that the board is currently set up, Amanda Parvati, JT Steven at the top of My Life is Fine, that's a pretty good place to be ranked, in my opinion. But Rob, why would you specifically place these two over Amanda and Parvati?
Because I feel like, yeah, peer pressure, you know, I would say that I feel like just the legend of, Steven and JT together, especially since they so clearly have skill sets that complement, each other, where I feel like that we talked about, Parvati and Amanda as being, two people with, sort of a similar, skill set. Although I feel like that, Parvati is probably the more outgoing person and Amanda is a little bit more of the more, introverted, pair in the group, that I feel like that, you know, JT's athleticism, like they just fit more classically into JT is the muscle, but Steven was the brains, where it's sort of like,
you know, go ahead.
No, I just feel like that sort of skill set of like, you know, with your brains and my muscles, like, I think we've really got something here. And they do ultimately make it all the way to the end. So I just feel like that the legend of Steven and JT is also, you know, built into this equation.
Yeah. And, you know, for the record, I like Steven and JT as individuals. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, people always say, like, but they learn so much from each other. And refresh my memory if I'm wrong here. What did JT learn from Steven? In the story that's been given to us, you know, I see that Steven's like, he learned how to fish or something. You know, it's like, so, like he learned how to be more country. I don't, a lot of it's from Steven's perspective and not JT's as far as I remember. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of it is like very revisionist opposed to what is the reality on the ground here. I find it, you know, I don't see as much, and I would like want to throw it back to y'all to convince me that there really was something deeper here beyond an excitement over day 39 breakfast and him throwing him under the bus at the very end, which I think are the best moments. But if that's the best, I really think that means they should be in My Life Is Fine.
But I think the myth is also contributing to it, right? I think almost the fact that you're saying like there's things are overblown, the fact that things are overblown in the first place almost speaks to like their that legendary status, you know, as opposed to like Crystal and Kenny have a lot of great moments, but I don't think people are being like iconic duos like Crystal and Kenny. You made so many salient points to put it up in this top tier where it deserves. I think Steven and JT are almost the opposite, right? You might argue that they are overrated, but you also might make the argument of, oh, because they are overrated, the fact that their legacy looms so large, I think has to be accounted for. I think, let me also go back to the point I made with Parvati and Amanda before, where Parvati and Amanda are known for having so many other pairings over the course of their Survivor careers. We're going to get to one in the next couple here. Mm-hmm. Steven and JT really don't have that. Steven has Jeremy, and that's about it. Again, these two, much like Colby and Jerry, have their Survivor legacies entirely tied to each other. Parvati and Amanda have a couple of fun seasons together, but they also have a lot of other people that they have various dynamics with.
So I think the compromise here is, I would say that Steven and JT should be ahead of Parvati and Amanda, but at the top of My Life Is Fine.
That's fine with me.
Does that work for you, Mike?
I mean, it's fine with me. We'll see how your ats are on Friday morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
We'll have to wipe the poop from all of our glasses.
Mm-hmm. You'll get a lot of traffic. It's a good thing.
Okay. If you say so. All right. Mike, what's next?
All right. Well, listen, we're talking about Parvati's Alliance members. They were once called the king and queen of the Villains Tribe. We are talking about Parvati and Russell Hance, who, Rob, you're going to be speaking about in various magnitudes this week.
All right, so is this the first time that a person has shown up on the list with a different dance partner?
Yes, we are doing a little bit of square dancing here. Everyone do-si-do and picked your much shorter partner here, I'm assuming so, because, you know, Parvati did play on Heroes vs. Villains with Amanda. We spoke about it, but I think more so, she is more well-known on Heroes vs. Villains for playing specifically alongside Russell.
Okay. Let me hear from Nigel. How do you feel about Parvati and Russell being on this list?
So, you know, I think that as we've already stated here, you know, Parvati does have other relationships. So you could count that as a knock against her being a duo with Russell here. But I don't think that the story of Heroes versus Villains is the same without that dynamic here. In Heroes versus Villains is considered by many people to be one of the best of all time. We'll see how it eventually finishes in the ranking here. But I think that Parvati and Russell really, they like to marinate in their villainy.
They really
embody the theme of the season. You know, one of the nicknames we came up with them was the mail carriers, because they intercept that letter. And it's just so much fun to see them, teasing JT, making fun of him. I think that they are people who are egging each other on a little bit in that way. And ultimately, when we get to the final tribal council of Heroes versus Villains, I think that Candace's jury speech does a really good job of explaining why it is that those two lose to Sandra ultimately. And it's the fact that they are inherently tied together in her mind. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's, to me, it's very easy to imagine these two as a duo. But what do you think?
I mean, we also talked about them being a bit Bonnie and Clyde. These real villains who have a very up and down relationship that's very intense. I mean, and a relationship that's so intense that you're fighting over Danielle DiLorenzo is wild to me.
Wow, who knew that they had that in common with Shane and Courtney?
Right. And I just think that their stories are very much intertwined. You know, a lot of people could argue that Parvati like lost votes because of her association with Russell. I the fact that it's kind of like a one-sided romance, even a little bit, I think adds to the excitement of that. And I know we said that Parvati is on here multiple times now, but as Courtney said about her, she'll flirt with literally anything, you know, and the Parvati Russell relationship is exciting, dynamic. He plays an idol on her. She hides things from him. They fight, go back and forth. I mean, there really isn't, I think, a lot of duos that have that type of like energy.
So definitely an interesting pair, Parvati and Russell. But, you know, as this is a Survivor Samoa week, I'm wondering, like, should the power couple that should be on the list, should it be Russell and Natalie White?
I just think it's not as powerful, like power from the television, right? I think that's the real difference here.
Yeah.
You know, I remember reading on Sucks a long time ago, someone was talking about why wasn't Stephanie Valencia as appreciated as some of like the other Russell girls, right? The Natalie Whites and the Russell Parvatis, the Russell girls, you know?
Like a Bond girl?
Well, Mike calls them his concubines in Redemption Island, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference is that what makes it fun is that Parvati and Natalie like hated Russell. like they worked with him, but they were very annoyed with him. They weren't like eating his crap the time, though they saw him as an ends to a mean, and that's really exciting. But I think Parvati and Russell are just more star power, more exciting, and their story is just more energetic because Natalie just barely gets anything.
I would not say that Natalie like dislikes Russell throughout the game in Survivor Samoa, and I feel like that Parvati at times, like, I think Parvati may dislike Russell but is good at faking it. I don't know if Natalie has like disdain for Russell during the 39 day filming of Survivor, probably at some later date.
Yeah, well, but I think also to that point, and as Kevin was saying, I think it's also a matter of like character as well. I think, you know, Kevin mentioned Yule and Becky before. I think there are a plethora of Survivor power couples where it is like alpha, bigger edit person and beta, smaller edit person, you know? And I think those are, I just think, less dynamic than like Parvati and Russell, who were two very big characters in their own rights on their separate seasons. And then when put together, their journeys were so much linked over heroes versus villains, from being on the outs of the villains tribe to like working their way into the majority to really against some sort of almost, you know, very just combustible dynamics of why didn't you hide the idol from me? And then I'm going to vote out your closest ally. And probably be like, well, I guess I'm stuck with Russell now, despite the fact that he voted out my number one. Like, there's so much give and take between these two, surprisingly so, that they are a power couple. They are the ones that rule the vast majority of Survivor heroes versus villains, but there's still a lot of bumps in the road along that way.
I'm interested to see where this one goes, because I feel like that while they succeed in really wrestling control of the villains tribe from Rob and Tyson, they succeed in getting the leg up on the heroes tribe, that really they are at odds for, you know, a good half of like the back half of the merge. So let's see where Parvati and Russell end up going. All right. So here they are. All right. Mike, do you have a opening offer for Parvati and Russell?
I guess I would say my life is fine, but I'm trying to figure out where to place it, on the taller end or the shorter end, because, you know, I do feel like these two have big roles to play in each other's journeys, and specifically heroes versus villains. But we just talked about this with Parvati and Micronesia, right? This is only one of three, in the case of Parvati, four seasons that each one will play. So they don't necessarily have that Steven and JT or Colby and Jerry dynamic of like every time they play a season, it's always going to be about Parvati's journey is always going to be about Russell and vice versa.
In fairness, they both have played without the other one and did not make the merge.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's very true. Maybe it's the Steven and JT they didn't even realize the entire time. But I think that the strength of how much their relationship contributed to the narrative of season 20 has to put it at least in my life is fine. But I will defer to you guys as to where exactly that placement comes in the grand scheme of things.
Okay. Nigel, do you have a strong feeling on where Russell and Parvati should go?
I agree with Mike. My life is fine. does feel like the correct place to put them. And, you know, I think it's a little bit difficult ranking them because I think that their overall score, if you will, is brought up by the fact that they are two titans of Survivor, but it is the relationship itself does not have that same je ne sais quoi, as Mike referred to earlier. I think that they like strong arm their way into My Life Is Fine, if you will. But I think that, you know, these two are not going to have a multi-season arc together in that same way. So, you know, maybe
I would argue that I would move them up ahead of Sue and Kelly, because I feel like they have more highlights together than Sue and Kelly did. And then also they have the public breakup like Sue and Kelly ultimately do. But along the way, I feel like that their resume together is more impressive than Sue and Kelly, who just, you know, voted together with the four.
Yeah, I think you make a good case. I have a huge bias towards Borneo, and I love Kelly and Sue. But I do think Russell and Parvati, there's just so much sparks there. I mean, Russell votes out Danielle because he believes that he and Parvati are supposed to be the power couple, right? I mean, like,
we're supposed to be the power couple.
You were the chosen one.
Right. And you could personally put them right under Parvati and Amanda, even, because, you know, Amanda is really linked to Ozzy, and Parvati kind of takes him out and then brings her back into the fold, in the same way that you could argue Russell and Parvati have that relationship after the Danielle vote, that maybe they have different relations with people, but they're very central to the story. There's an epicness to their roles within the cast, within the zeitgeist, as Russell, you know, pretty much believes he should have won, that he was robbed, and then in mid reunion starts saying that Parvati should have won instead. It is like a really interesting pair that I think, you know, should be towards the high end of My Life Is Fine.
Okay, well, how high?
You wanted to do the back to back Parvatis, right, Kevin?
That's what I think, but I, you know, I'm open to hearing Rob's thoughts or anyone else's.
I'm good putting them either right in front or right behind of Jenna and Heidi. I do think that they're probably stronger than Tom and Ian in just the levels of their Survivor characters. But the Jenna and Heidi stuff is just so strong.
Yeah.
It's really like split hairs between these two.
I am compelled by keeping Parvati together. I mean, I feel like that's sort of like, weighs in their favor.
We got the pair going on.
Yeah, and it makes sense that Russell is right behind Amanda, considering that Amanda has had one more jury vote than him. So I think real connection there.
Okay. All right, let's do it. All right, Mike, who's next?
All right, well, we talked about a pair from Survivor 18. We talked about a pair from Survivor 20. Let's talk about a pair from Survivor 18 and 20. People might argue, you know, there were four big characters in Survivor Token Cheats. I think there were more than four, but I guess the big four were Steven, were JT, and these other two. We are talking the coach and his one-time assistant coach, Tyson Apostle.
Okay. Nigel, tell me about Tyson and Coach as a pair.
So, you know, these are another pair that we have here that do get a multi-season arc, even though, you know, the second season does not have nearly as much substance to it, I guess, if you will. You know, they're obviously both big players within the zeitgeist of Survivor. I think that, you know, for me personally, something that kind of harms the legacy of Coach and Tyson as a duo is the fact that there is so much more to both of their stories that comes afterwards, mm-hmm. that is not necessarily explicitly linked together in that same way. But you know, they're both big characters with long hair. So we thought it would be appropriate to name these two long hair, don't care, you know, low hanging fruit that we figured that we had to go to. But Kevin, what are your thoughts on these two?
Yeah. I mean, Tyson and Coach, you know, the reason we did long hair don't care is because they kind of let their freak flag fly and are really embracing that quality. I also thought maybe naming them team apathetic and pathetic, not because that's who they are, but that's the edit that they received in Token Cheats, for the record. I think based on their own admissions, even.
Yeah.
That I do think there's the coach, co-coach storyline that exists, but they are kind of a trio with Debbie. And while they do have a follow-up in Heroes versus Villains, Tyson's edit is really minimal. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to me to put them really that high in this overall. I found actually myself thinking about them, not really able to generate a lot of moments and ideas.
Yeah. Mike, I say that these two are more of a fun duo that are fun on the screen. But as far as Survivor power couples, I don't think I would have had Tyson and Coach too high up on my personal list.
I mean, yeah, they're a tight duo, especially in Token Sheens. And they do have the fact that it does recur in another season, right? Tyson is the one to pull Coach aside and is like, hey, I'm going to give you some advice right now. You know, don't put the feathers in your hair. Don't go espousing platitudes, which Coach doesn't really follow whatsoever, especially since Tyson is gone. I mean, I would say the strongest part of their relationship is probably the pre-merge of Token Sheens. I think what is going to place this couple low is the fact that, going back to what you said all the way in the second couple we talked about, Rob, like, this really isn't a power couple.
Yeah.
They are never really in a position of power, except maybe during like the Brendan vote, but that's about it. In both cases, Tyson's going to get blindsided and Coach is going to be on the wrong side of the vote.
And really, if you were going to try to come up with who is Tyson in a power couple with, probably Jervis. If you were going to ultimately find like the Coconut Bandits, I feel like that's probably not as fun television, but I feel like probably the person that Tyson had the best working relationship with in his Survivor playing experience.
You never forget your first, though, and that's Coach for Tyson.
Sure. All right. So let's look at where they place on the board. I definitely don't feel like they should be in Forget You, Go Home, Goodbye. I feel like that they are not in the same league as Courtney and Shane.
I agree, but I think they should be below Colby and Jerry.
Okay. Kevin, how do you feel about Coach and Tyson being right behind Colby and Jerry?
I think that makes sense. I just wanted to make sure that they were still below Pascal and Nalia, because I think Pascal and Nalia showed more power, essentially. I think are more inherently linked. And it's unfortunate just because they have such low, I think, name ID over 40 seasons of Survivor, that they're ranked so low and it feels like maybe they should be higher. But, you know, it's all arbitrary. So I'm very happy with where they're at.
Hey, this is the show all about arbitrary and reductive. Okay.
Just check Rob's ads on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of reasons why Steven doesn't like this show. Okay. Okay. Then let's talk about what is next, Mike.
What is next? It's a relationship so good you could kiss it right on the lips. We are talking about John Cochran and Dawn Meehan from Survivor South Pacific, and the top two finishers from Survivor Karamoan.
Yeah. Okay. Cochran and Dawn as a power couple. All right. Nigel, tell me about these two.
So, you know, looking at the two season arc that we get for Cochran and Dawn, I don't think that you're going to find many people arguing that these two were controlling their South Pacific game, right? But they are undoubtedly a power couple in Karamoan. You know, I'll let Kevin get into it a bit. He really enjoys a specific confessional where you get to hear Dawn talk about Cochran and how she views him when they get to the merge and are considering that flip there. The nickname we came up for these two was Team Flip Flop, because they had to ponder whether or not they wanted to flip at the merge. But in the end, it was going to be a flop either way, because I don't think that they were going to be able to get to that end game in South Pacific.
Yeah, but I'll let you talk about that confessional, Dawn. And I think, you know, it's, you know, Cochran flips, Dawn flops, essentially, as they end up on different sides of the vote. And so that's why I link those two together. You know, after the talking with T-Bird with Dawn, which was a great episode, highly recommend. You know, I remember tweeting a quote from Dawn from that merge episode where she kind of talks about, you know, this Survivor's a game of casualties, but I don't want Cochran to be a casualty. I mean, there's like a real intensity about this relationship. You know, we talked about Tom and Ian feeling very father son. This feels very mother son in many ways. And, you know, Dawn says herself that Cochran reminds her of one of her children.
Yeah.
So they have to be on the list. I don't find it the most exciting group. You know, trying to think of a couple nickname beyond Flip Flop, I try to combine their names. Like, but Dawn,
I think Mother Boy.
You know, like, you know, there's Dockerin. You know, not exactly exciting, but I am somewhat partial to Cock On. And I I just think there's something about them that certainly is interesting. They're really big characters in both of their seasons, but they're not my favorite.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a unique dynamic from what we've experienced so far, where I wouldn't say they were rivals. I think Kevin brought up a good point about the confessional, but they do end up on opposite sides by the end of it. Dawn is not the one, you know, saying you disgust me or singing Cochrane, you screwed me over at Ponderosa. But I think she certainly feels bitter by what Cochrane did to her. Cut to them being each other's tightest allies in Kara Moen, I think is an interesting story. I just wonder if, sort of like Kenny and Crystal, if the editing doesn't necessarily point to that. And so we didn't get as much of that story as maybe we're trying to infer.
Yep. We talked about this because we watched those two seasons back to back in the top 40 countdown. This was a duo that was really like forged in fire. They're both on the outs at Savaii in the early days, and they're working together from the beginning of that game. They come back together and then are basically together for the entire 39 days of Survivor Kara Moen. So I think this is a good duo, but I don't know necessarily if we think of them as a very powerful duo together. I'm sure Cochrane's game benefited from what Dawn brought to the table, but I don't know. I feel like that this is one that does not necessarily capture the imaginations of the Survivor faithful.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of these people, like, if they were on The Amazing Race, you'd be really excited about. I don't know how excited I am about Dawn and Cochrane, even though their stories are very much linked. I think they obviously do care about each other. But it just is not very invigorating. And I think it's maybe because it's on the backdrop of two very low-ranked seasons as well.
Okay, let's see where they land. All right, Cochrane and Dawn. I think they are not in the same league with Shane and Courtney. That's fair to say, right?
So they actually liked each other.
Yeah, I mean, Nigel, how high do you think we should go?
So, you know, I think it's fair to compare them to Nalia and Pascal. You know, it's another duo that was pretty successful.
The opposite May-December type of dynamic.
it's one with, like, someone who could be the age of the parent to the other person. It's, you know, you get some very sweet, warm moments between the two of them. But in the grand scheme of the show that is Survivor, they're not necessarily both duos that come to mind as the most exciting. So keeping these two close together, I think, is a fair ranking.
And it's interesting, Pascal and Nalia, like, love each other. That Pappy loves Nalia. Nalia loves Pappy. The two of them that have nothing but kind words. I think that Dawn is fond of Cochrane. I don't think you get, Mike, a confessional where Cochrane is like, you know who's the greatest person ever? Dawn. Love Dawn.
Yeah, but is that Cochrane, though? I feel like Cochrane's confessional style is like always bemuse something that is happening. Not many positive Cochrane confessionals, I would say. Even if when they were self-effacing. So I don't think it's really Cochrane's MO to necessarily heap praise onto anybody or anything at any point in time.
Yes, has Cochrane ever been complimentary of another person and not just like in like, oh, Malcolm, what a like this like a great physique?
Yes, that's the thing. Like, there's always a bite to it, right? Almost of like, oh, this is unbelievable. Look at this guy. Like, I don't think Cochrane has had a sincere confessional where he's like, Dawn has been so supportive to me. She helped, you know, rub calamine lotion on the sunburn that I got. Like, I really appreciate Dawn.
Yeah, even when his own dad showed up, he's like, my dad is here. What does he think he is, with sunglasses? Like, he's a cool guy now?
Exactly. You don't go to Cochrane for sentimentality. That's not in his toolbox. And maybe that's where Dawn sort of fills in those blanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she cares for two, essentially. And arguably it's a lot.
Yeah, I do feel like that in that way of the Steven and JT of it all. Like, I feel like that Dawn is like a lot of heart and Cochrane does not really have that gear. So I do feel like that they do complement each other particularly well.
Yeah, I would say I personally like would probably put Courtney and Jerry above them, Courtney, Colby and Jerry, just from my own perspective. But I do think that they might get the bump because to Rob's chagrin, they did work together, right? And Colby and Jerry never really have outside of a couple of votes in Survivor the Australian.
That's interesting. Colby and Jerry function more as a couple. Dawn and Cochrane functioned with more power. So I don't know. Kevin, what do you think?
You know, I here's the thing. I feel like Dawn and Cochran should be after Pascal and Amelia. In the way that like the Parvatis are connected, I feel like these two feel very fair connected enough to me. But it does seem strange that they are above Colby and Jerry when I look at it like this. So I don't know if that means Colby and Jerry should be ahead of Pascal and Amelia, but you know, I'm fine with how this is right now.
Okay. All right. Nigel, you feel good?
Yeah, I think that this is a good spot for them. And ultimately, if you are trying to also take into consideration how successful were these two, clearly Cochran and Dawn were more successful as a duo than Colby and Jerry. So I think that's a good spot.
All right. Okay, we are down to our final six couples, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got?
Yeah, almost top five. So this next one, we talked about them before. I'm not just going to speak about how much I love them. I'm going to Matt sing it. We are, of course, talking about Denise and Malcolm from Survivor Philippines.
All right. Malcolm and Denise, iconic duo, right, Kevin?
Yeah. Very iconic. I think I prefer like Stephanie and Bobby John more, you know, at the end of the day. I think they're definitely the more iconic ones, Malcolm and Denise. But, you know, other than having a certain amount of respect for one another, I don't feel like we really explore what makes each other like one another that much more, except that like they're both good at challenges and they both kind of dislike Russell Swan. It just really isn't like all, I just don't feel like there's a lot of meat there beyond the story, which is very exciting. So we named them the Matt Singh Mercenaries. Because they survive and they you know, crush the other sides as they get split up and come back together.
Yeah.
Though I really wanted to, since they voted out Angie Layton and wore a lot of blue, I wanted to name them Team Cookie Monsters. But
Very scary.
Cookie Monsters are interesting to me, you know, and I think
about those cookies.
Nice.
Yeah. The Malcolm and Denise relationship is interesting. While I definitely understand, like, maybe we did not get shown or told enough about it. Like, I do feel like that, like, knowing some of these people over the time, the Malcolm and Denise relationship is like as like genuine, like as it comes, where a lot of these people did not remain in each other's lives. That I think that Malcolm and Denise like are still like incredibly close to this day.
Yeah. And, you know, Rob, to your point, I recall during Winners at War, a lot of tweeting from Malcolm on behalf of his duo partner here. I think that ultimately, if we're going to give a little bit of a penalty to Crystal and Kenny for the dynamic between the two of them not being discussed as much, I think that it is fair to apply that as well to Malcolm and Denise. But, you know, their stories are essentially mirror each other, right? They make it out of Matt Singh together. They go to opposite tribes. They make it through somehow and get to the merge and go through together. And they only turn on each other because at Final Four, they both recognize that they cannot go against the other, right? If they go against Lisa and Scoopin, they will win and they want to be the one person who does that. So from that point of view, I think that it's an interesting positioning between the two of them, but I think it's the dynamic itself that I don't find to pop quite as much as some of the other couples on the list.
I think it pops initially, right? They're the ones in the episode one who like seek out each other and are like, this person's on my wavelength. And oftentimes when it's just, you're the calm in the torrential storm that we're in right now, that is the Matt Singh tribe, I think there is value in that. I think what doesn't help is we sort of concentrate less on that relationship as the season moves forward, right? Because Matt Singh was such a brilliant storyline for the first four episodes. They get separated. They sort of have their own separate things. Malcolm bros down with Pete. Denise gets in with the guys of Calabar. And then when they come back together, we get a little bit of Denise, Malcolm commiseration, but not as much of a focus as it was before. So it's almost like Tyson and Coach in that the strongest part of their duo was in the first third of the season. But when it was happening, like, it was hot. I think this is another example of different walks of life. This is, you know, a long-haired fratty bro from California and a sex therapist from Iowa come together. Like, this sounds like an improv sketch. And so to have them meet and become each other's tightest allies, making it to the Final Four against all odds, I do think is a very iconic story, one that Stephanie and Bobby John themselves weren't able to accomplish.
Yeah, and I definitely think that there is more reverence for each other between Malcolm and Denise than there ever was with Stephanie and Bobby John, who...
We experienced that a few weeks ago, that there is no love lost.
We're not sure if Stephanie and Bobby John even liked each other at any point. All right.
Fun.
Yes. Let's see where they go. Kevin, do you have a starting spot for Malcolm and Denise?
Well, they are so iconic that it's hard to not put them below My Life is Fine. I feel like, you know, I like both of them individually. I'm not moved by their dynamic, even though the story is really interesting. I put them behind Sue and Kelly because I do think Sue and Kelly have more levels, and it's to me it's more exciting, but I recognize that they'll probably leapfrog a few people in this tier, but I think this is a good tier.
That feels low to be this far down. I think they're the 10th spot on this list right now.
I think definitely above Sue and Kelly. I think arguably above Tom and Ian, because again, that story is so epic and one that up to this point still has not been done before. We're going to talk about a pair that again might be comparable to Tom and Ian and how the game ends. Jenna and Heidi were bigger characters, but like, does that outweigh the plot of Malcolm and Denise if you're more of a plot versus a character person? I'm not sure, but I think it's at least in the spot that we're putting it now, in my opinion.
I still feel like this is low. I mean, I have a hard time saying that Russell and Parvati were better than Malcolm and Denise.
I would agree with that.
You know, I think what's a little bit tough for how I'm trying to rank them here is that Malcolm and Denise are certainly an iconic duo. When you think of duos, the fact that they survived Matt Singh together and then basically duke it out in the end, I think is a... almost a perfect duo story in that way. But again, for me, it comes back to the dynamic itself between the two of them does not just pop for me in the way that I think it does for Russell and Parvati, Heidi and Jenna. You could actually, for me, probably argue Amanda and Parvati, but I think that we're accurate in the area here. It's probably a little bit of semantics and where exactly you want to rank them in this group.
So I also feel like that Malcolm and Denise, I feel like that they pass the and test of while Malcolm goes off and has his own adventures and then comes back for Game Changers and Denise comes back for her own stint back. I still think that, you know, Malcolm blank, I feel like you are going to get to Malcolm and Denise pretty quick.
I mean, the problem with me with Malcolm and Denise is that, like, I don't know if they're even that much better than Tom and Ian, as far as I'm concerned, because Tom and Ian have the opposite, right? They're not the Matt Singh or the Oolong. They're the Karors. Their stories are inherently linked in a way that's like a bit of a rivalry. They have a sense of closeness that feels really described in their relationship. Malcolm and Denise don't really have that, except just a respect for each other's like work ethic. Like, that's not particularly interesting to me or fascinating, even though I do think the Matt Singh story is particularly engaging, but I just don't I just don't really see it as that exciting, and maybe that's just where I come down on it.
Excitement maybe no, but I just feel like that I think that they should be ahead of Amanda and Parvati as well, just because I think that the story of that season is that they came from Matt Singh, unlike Tom and Ian or Parvati and Amanda. Like, there's no, or even Steven and JT with Taj. Like, there's no third person that you can point to that, yeah, it's Malcolm, Denise, and also this other third person who was working with them. Like, it was just them.
I think linking them with Steven and JT would also make sense, because again, if we're sort of coupling it as like couples that have almost like transcended to the Survivor mythos, I feel like both sets of duos do that, right? Where everyone's saying like, oh, the opposites of Steven and JT, or oh, the intentional Matt Singh, can they, you know, if they winnow down to two people, will they rely on each other for the rest of the game? Like Malcolm and Denise, like these two couples almost stand for something larger than their reality was, and I do think that bears a lot of weight.
Yeah, I guess for me though, like I don't put as much into the mythos, because I want to base it in the reality. As Eric Cardona said, perception's not reality, you know, like, and it's
I find Scoopin' and Lisa, and I know Scoopin' is not the most popular person in the world, a much more interesting duo, because there's this conflict about, do they take the deserving or do they not? And they were both bonded by their faith and the fact that Scoopin' was a fan of Lisa, you know, and how that all works out. You know, Denise was willing to take Malcolm to the end until the final day, essentially. I mean, and you would think that'd be like a really exciting thing, but I don't think it really is, except that she talks to Lisa in the last 20 minutes and then it's like, okay, fine, I'll vote Malcolm off. I think it's fine that they are linked with Steven and JT, but I think consistent to my record, I also would put JT and Steven lower, but I'm fine with them being in that same like one for one, because that keeps the Parvatis together as well.
Okay. Can we live with this? Right now for people listening at home, Malcolm and Denise are currently fifth overall behind Steven and JT, fourth at the top of the My Life is Fine tier, but one ahead of Amanda and Parvati, who are sixth.
I think that, you know, at this point, this is fair. If, you know, we are linking the parties together, I think it's appropriate to link two duos whose story transcend the mythos has grown beyond them of JT and Steven and Malcolm and Denise.
Okay. Yeah, I keep those parties together. We can't split them up.
We can't split the parties.
All right. Mike, how are you feeling?
I'm good. I'm feeling good about this. Okay. But we're not done talking Survivor Philippines, Rob.
We're not.
We've reached our top five, baby. And this is a weird one because this is a Survivor power couple that went on to become a real life couple. We are talking about Abby Maria and Pete from Survivor Philippines.
Rob,
I think Rob says it all.
Yeah.
I detect some thoughts, Rob. Let's hear it.
I mean, that there are many Survivor couples who became like dating pairs after playing together. We are not talking about, and I mean, there are many, you know, Survivor marriages, even of people who got together after the seasons are over. To me, Pete and Abby Maria, if we're going on what was on the screen, this is like, they're a fun duo, but I don't think that they're a top 50 Survivor power couple.
I mean, I think they are, in the sense that, like, you know, Pete gets in the way of Abby and RC. I think that's a really interesting story. I mean, and then he kind of works with Abby and then realizes that maybe she's not the best person to have. It's just this like shocking reality as the madness ensues, where then Abby reveals they have the idol. Like, and they both, I think, are very different people. I think Pete is very analytical and actually probably an introvert at the end of the day. And Abby is just like firing off all the time. I just think they're very different people that come together in a very villainous package in a way that is really fun for, you know, the season that is the Philippines.
I think that these two are essentially agents of chaos who mm-hmm. promote chaos, but in very different ways, obviously. If we're looking at how these two could be a power couple, I think what hurts them is the fact that their tribe does not go to tribal until they're at the merge, right? They never have to go to a pre-merge tribal. So they're never in the situation where they're actually voting anybody else out. So they're not able to take control of their tribe in that same way.
Yeah.
You know, to me, these two are my Joker and Harley Quinn, if mm-hmm. you will. Pete is there, as Kevin said, creating tension between Abby Maria and RC. He's able to like weaponize Abby to his benefit. And I think that, you know, those two are tied to each other for the rest of the game.
You literally, when Pete goes home, you know, it's the votes being split between Abby and Pete, right? And the idol that Pete helped Abby receive is the one that makes him go home. So the stories are very linked. The fact that they had an on and off again whirlwind romance post show, I think adds to that in a way. That I think they definitely, you know, should be on this list in general, though I recognize they may not be in a high tier.
Mike, are they not a trio with artists?
Well, I would say on the show, yes, but
not off the show. I was not implying that.
No, well, listen, power thruple, whatever you want. I think what separates this, though, is the fact that this does continue off screen. I mean, Rob, you mentioned it, but I can't think of many relationships of people who worked together on the show and then became romantically entangled. What? Whitney and Keith, Sebastian and Jenna, but like those personalities pale in comparison to Abby Maria and Pete. I think that if these are serving as sort of the representation of like, hey, we starved together on an island and then we got off and got schmoopy, like that, that is such an interesting dynamic to me that I think differentiates this. This is a power couple that if we're talking about Rombert going on to do things outside of Survivor as a couple, I think we have to include like discussion of Abby Maria and Pete as well when it comes to extracurricular activities.
I mean, so that if there are people that were on a season together and then they get married, they should be on the list. That's that's basically what we're looking at.
I feel like you're talking me into a trap. Is there a couple?
What if they're having a baby also? Should they be on the list also? If this is the automatic criteria of a post-game relationship?
I would say they're at least meeting some of the criteria, but I think that Abby and Pete check off enough additional boxes to earn their spot. And more importantly, you know, a lot of the Survivor couples, you saw them on screen and were like, we saw why they worked and that why they'd be a good couple. That was not the case with Abby and Pete. And the fact that they decided to still date after that adds to them being an epic power couple, even though they may not be as epic as a lot of the other people on this list. I think it's fair that they're in the top 20.
Let's take a look at this. I feel like that they are only ahead of Shane and Courtney.
I might put Shane and Courtney ahead of them.
All right. So Kevin and Nigel, you both feel very, very strongly. I'm interested that that between you two, are there like things that you have wildly different takes on? I feel like that you two have agreed on most of the spots on the list. The sign of a great power couple that never arguing.
Jenna and Heidi, we really compliment each other. We don't have as many differences. I think maybe in some regards, Nigel is definitely, go ahead. Just go ahead. I was going to say, I think that we don't always necessarily value the same thing, but I think we often come to similar answers. I've described it to people as we are different math equations, but for some reason, the answer
new
is
math and old
similar.
Math.
Yeah. I think that when I look at these things, I look for that je ne sais quoi. I like to see what that magic spark is. And Kevin really wants to be able to like itemize down exactly what all of the pieces are that come together.
It's called evidence. It's called evidence and it's called logic. And I use that and it's fair.
Okay.
Nigel and I, we were watching, Big Brother. And I think quite often Nigel is more sympathetic and he thinks about like the social relationships and I'm more strategic oriented. But because that's the way we think about these shows, I actually would argue that it makes me value the social like depth of a relationship building because it's different for me. And Nigel really likes the more explosive strategy. Right. So there is differences.
So give me the spot for Abby Maria and Pete, bro.
I think they, because they're a romantic pairing, there's not a lot of romantic pairs on this list. I think they are better than Pascal and Leo. But I understand that does seem like not a popular opinion right now.
Okay.
So I would say, we're talking iconic Survivor power couples. I certainly believe that the Abby Maria Gomez is iconic.
Sure.
I don't believe.
No doubt.
That Pete is iconic in the grand scheme of things. You put them together, and I think that there is some
half
magic.
Iconic.
So is considered a great season, partly for what they bring to the table here. So, I think that they deserve to be on this list, but they should be on Forget You, Go Home, Goodbye.
Okay.
And I think maybe it's fair that Courtney and Shane should still be the last place because it just feels true to form, and maybe they're just one step above them.
I love it. Mike?
Yeah.
You good?
I'm good with that as well. I mean, look, we're talking iconic Survivor power couples. They're not only one of them is iconic. They were both on Survivor together. They were sort of in power for two tribal councils, and they were a couple, but are no longer one. So it's like they're oddly not satisfying any of the criteria, which I think is fine putting them in the bottom tier right now.
Okay. All right. So Abby and Pete. Okay. Forget You, Go Home, Goodbye. All right. Mike, who's next?
All right, we are skipping to the Blood versus Water seasons, obviously brought in a bunch of pre-existing relationships. We spoke about a lot of parent-child relationships beforehand. Of course, we cannot talk Blood versus Water without talking the dynamic duo of Laura Moret and Sierra Easton.
Okay. Kevin, this is an interesting one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's one of the most epic couples of all time. I mean, we're talking about, we like Tom and Ian because they feel like father and son. Laura and Sierra are literally related. And I do think we quite often flanderize this blood versus water experience as like, she bought it out her mom. And it's because we kind of minimize, I think, Laura Moret's, I think, perspective, because I think she's the more interesting one when it comes to all of that. Like Laura realizing that she's seeing her daughter, who she's seen struggle with these obstacles, you know, that Laura also had children at a very young age, watch her become like a fully like realized woman who wants to take the game for herself, sure. I think is really beautiful. And it is, as Laura said, worth $1 million. And so I think this is a very, they're intrinsically linked. I think their story is really exciting, even if it's been a bit overplayed. Nige?
Yeah, you know, I think that what I really like about their dynamic here is that it is something that transcends the show. I don't know how many couples on this list can really claim that the dynamic that they bring transcends the show. I think that Nudie and Rudy represent something more than just themselves. And I think that this mother-daughter duo where, you know, one of them does vote the other out, as we've liked to mention before, Jeff really likes to say she voted out her mom, but there was real emotion behind that. And so for me, that makes them a powerful entry on this list. I think what kind of hurts them is that they aren't necessarily thought of as iconic Survivor players separately. I think that they are both big characters. I think that they are both memorable, but I don't know that they are both considered iconic. So I think that that harms them in the ranking. Yeah.
It's an interesting dynamic. Mike, did they ever have any power together?
I think they worked with the whole Tyson group at the merge, right? Like, despite being back together, they joined up with the rest of the singles and said, hey, GTFO, other couples. So they did have a portion of time. Other than that, they were separated for the game. I think this is going to be one of those picks that serves as like an avatar, because I do think Sierra and Laura are sort of like the representation of blood versus water pairs in my eyes. Like, when I'm thinking about other iconic blood versus water pairs, I can think of like maybe John and Jacqueline as another mm-hmm. one.
Yeah.
That maybe Wes and Keith, but I feel like, again, not to go back to the she voted out her mom moment, but I feel like that is what Jeff points to as like the pinnacle of blood versus water, of this game is so cutthroat, you can even vote out your own mother. And so I do feel like, again, if we're talking about transcending the mythos, Laura and Sierra sort of have that edge above those other couples yeah. I spoke about.
I mean, Laura does have like the motherly relationship with some of the women in Survivor Samoa, sort of like the like cool mom slash older sister with Monica and people like Natalie and trying to and Kelly Sharbaugh. And then we get to see her with her real life daughter. She is seemingly totally cool with her daughter voting her out, because it feels like that they are truly playing together. So I think there is power in that. So it's an interesting dynamic. Let's see where it lands on the list. Okay. Nigel, do you have a starting offer for Laura and Sierra?
I think that the fact that these two are not dominating the game and getting to the end, you know, does make it harder to rank them above, let's say, Malcolm and Denise and JT and Steven. But for me, the emotion, the transcendence of the show does pack a powerful punch. Yeah. So I personally would not put them too far behind those two couples.
So I'm looking at the board right now, and I see Kelly and Sue, who we described as sort of these two people, but I wonder if they fit the dynamic of another, like a mother and daughter pair. I know that Sue said she saw Kelly as a friend, but I wonder, Kevin, does that make sense? Is that sort of like the like fake mother-daughter relationship with a real mother-daughter relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that makes all sense, that you can put them above Kelly and Sue. You know, I think that makes sense to me. I'm a big fan of Team Teen Mom, and you know, there is just, I do technically think they should be above them if this is the order that we're going for in this tier.
I would stop them here, though, personally. I think there's more there with literally every other couple above them. I think the thing about Lauren Sierra is that, like, there's some good stuff there, but I feel like because they spend so little time together, we're not getting as much. Whereas, like, you could even say, yes, Denise and Malcolm and JT and Steven didn't have a lot of, like, or Crystal and Ketting didn't have a lot of, like, interpersonal moments, but we still got a lot of them as a duo. We didn't really get a lot of Laura and Sierra as a duo.
Yeah, they weren't on the same tribe for much of the game. They basically were on the same tribe for basically in the game, what, like 6 days?
Laura was barely on any tribe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that this speaks a bit to just the dynamic that was Blood versus Water. I think it's appropriate to have representation from Blood versus Water in this ranking, but I think that these are all good points to be making here.
Okay.
We have two honorary mentions for team names, if you would like to hear them.
Yes, please.
We have, it's a mother effing stick.
Yes.
And then, Mike, in honor of the great work that you do with Josh Wiggler on the Lost Down the Hatch podcast, we also have All the Best Cowboys Have Mommy Issues.
Yes, All the Best Mommies. I love it. It's a long one, but I will tweet this. I will waste 100+ characters on that hashtag any day.
Okay. All right. Then, Mike, what do we have next? Our last three.
Last three. Well, I heard the bellboy at the door, but I see some flashing lights out the window. Looks like Cops R Us are here. We're talking about multi-season dynamics. We've got to talk about one that we've experienced as recently as Survivor 40. We're talking Tony and Sarah.
Yes. Okay. This is another three-season arc. Second one, kind of a dud before we come all the way back with an epic third season. Kevin, can you tell us about Tony and Sarah?
You know, Tony and Sarah, I feel like their three-story arc is quite often compared to Jerry and Colby's. And I've always, as an old school purist, always like bristled at that. They're like, there are no Jerry and Colby because the second season doesn't really count. That being said, they get a really good send-off, and that's really hard to ignore. The fact that they're both police officers and that, you know, Tony votes Sarah out in Cagayan, you know, and he beats her at the very end in season 40. It's hard not to see them as an iconic couple. They certainly are. And, you know, they even have an own alliance name, Cops R Us, though we really preferred Team Law and Order. But I think we really end up settling on Team Law and Order Criminal Intent.
Yeah. Okay. Mike.
Cop to Criminal Intent.
Is there any recency bias in terms of looking at Tony and Sarah? Or do we have enough space from season 40?
I think we have enough space from season 40. But I mean, considering that the last Survivor episode that we've watched from the new variety had Tony like reduced to tears for the first time in his 3-season career, sobbing profusely at sending Sarah off in the fire making challenge. I think it's an incredibly interesting dynamic. It's a little bit, you know, like the Dawn and Cochran in that, like, in Cagayan, they made the alliance together, but then Tony rallies his allies to get rid of Sarah, and Sarah was even targeting Tony at the merge. So they were clearly not seeing eye to eye. They thought they were coming back for round two in Game Changers, doesn't end up working out. And then round three, they are one of the most vital elements of each other's games, in my opinion. From when Tony rubs charcoal on Sarah to have her disguise to sneak into the other camp, these two are incredibly important to their journeys through the wildly hectic game that was Winners at War.
Nigel, these two, I feel like, have a relationship that has everything that we're looking for. It spans across seasons. It is a relationship to two people that have won the game separately. There's a lot of power there, emotional send-off. They have a nickname. They function well together that I don't think that Tony could have won season 40 without Sarah. What's the argument to not have them in the top tier?
I think the best argument to not have them in the top tier, actually, I think the two would be potential recency bias. But, you know, I think that if you're looking at Survivor's iconic players, we often think of some of the people who played much earlier in the show's history, the people who have had so much longer to develop their legends, if you will. But I think it's hard to argue that Tony and Sarah are not giants of the new school era. Tony is a two-time winner. Sarah goes out in a extremely exciting tribal council her first season, comes back to win, and is kicked out by Tony right at the very end of Winners at War, the season that brings together all the people who have already won. I think that, you know, these two are just they're new school giants. There's no way around it.
Yeah.
And even looking at the fact that the second season is a dud as far as their dynamic on screen. I've heard the interviews where Sarah talks about how she was on the phone with Tony every single day. He was always going on about another scheme that he was planning. So I think that, you know, we at least got some backstory on that. There would have been some coordination if there was an opportunity for it.
Mike, let me make an argument here against Tony and Sarah, where I feel like that they almost have like the opposite of Steven and JT, in that they have both won a season of Survivor with little help from the other. That Sarah effectively won a season of Survivor where she never stepped foot on the same beach as Tony. And Tony went on to win. He worked with Sarah in the pre-merge, but really it was only for 12 days and they swapped. And then basically they were at odds when they got back together. And Tony goes on to win a season. So they both have like a respective win under their belt without the assistance of the other. And it's only in Winners at War that we got to see the full, you know, Cops R Us alliance working together.
Yes, but though Tony was far from the minds of the players by the time like day seven or so rolls around on Survivor Game Changers, you can't tell me there's a little Tony sitting on Sarah Lucina's shoulder throughout the entirety of Survivor Game Changers,
Sarah,
right?
Sarah, look.
No, Sarah, take her legacy advantage. Vote her out. No one will care, Sarah.
Yeah. Sarah.
But that's the thing, is I think the adage of I played like a cop, now I'm going to play like a criminal, I think in part came from the game that Tony played in Cagayan.
Yeah.
Where she looked at him and said, this is a guy who has the same badge as me and was able to like completely play a ruthless game and win. No holds barred. Let me do the same thing. So while I will say that, yes, they did win independently of each other, I do think that Tony influenced Sarah's game a good amount in Game Changers, in giving her really the limits or lack thereof of what she can do when playing Survivor.
All right. Let's look at the board. What do we do with Tony and Sarah?
I think it's got to be top tier.
All right.
I know.
Let's try this on. All right. They're in the top tier. Kevin, I know you love Kenny and Crystal. How could I not put Tony and Sarah ahead of Kenny and Crystal?
Is that I think Kenny and Crystal make Gabon great. And I feel like here's the issue I'm having here. Is that I think Sarah really drags this pair down. And I know Sarah has a fans. I think she deservingly won her season. I think she's a very good game player based on that. And it's not hard to do a whole lot better than she did in Cagayan, where she was constantly being misled. I just don't find Sarah as captivating. I don't think she finds her sea legs as a character truly. Mm-hmm. Until Winners at War, where I think she definitely pops a lot more. I'm fine with this being in Worth Playing For, because I would rank them above JT and Steven. You know, I obviously have a huge personal bias to Crystal and Kenny, but I recognize that it feels harder and harder to defend against the masses that supposedly, do stuff on the internet.
Well, just record wise here. I think it's hard to argue with the resume of Tony and Sarah as a duo, as compared to Kenny and Crystal, who top out at fifth and sixth place respectively. When we take a look at the other people that are on the board here, you have Rob and Amber, both like respective winners, placed first and second in their season. We have Rudy and Nudie, first and third. Tony and Sarah, like a
both respective winners, a first place and fourth place in Winners at War. Stephen and JT, first and second. Malcolm and Denise, first and fourth place. Amanda and Parvati, first and second. So Kenny and Crystal are just the outliers here in terms of like not even a top four finish between them.
I think that, you know, if we're looking at the way that we have Worth Playing For broken down right now, Rob and Amber, Rudy and Rich, Kenny and Crystal, Sarah, Tony, you could almost break them into two groups. Tony and Sarah and Rob and Amber are the most successful of all of these duos, whereas Rich and Rudy and Kenny and Crystal kind of represent more than just the two of them.
Yeah, and so, I see so that.
I think that the four of them, these four duos, are here kind of for different reasons. I think that it's really hard to argue against the success of Tony and Sarah. I agree that Sarah as a character does not seem to completely blossom until Winners at War. I do think there is a bit of a question as to, did producers and editors know exactly what to do for Sarah?
Well, let me ask you a question, Nigel, as the world's biggest Amber fan, how does Amber as a character relate to Sarah as a character?
What I love about Amber is that it feels like they just took a random lady at the grocery store and put her on Survivor with some of the craziest people that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's fun to see how this like seemingly normal person is actually a three-time player, a winner, considered to be one of the biggest legends. I mean, when they announced Winners at War, you know, Amber is one of like those big names that was, I guess, publicized by production there. I think that Sarah as a character for most people probably peaks above Amber, but for me personally, no, but I'm biased. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. So this argument about this foursome is interesting. Does it speak to, should Tony and Sarah be next to Rob and Amber, if that's the case, or do we like the bookends?
Oh, it's a good question. Because you can make the argument, do we like divide, clean down the middle? Because Tony and Sarah do have the advantage of the multi-season arc, right, that Rudy and Rich don't. So the question is, like, how does that iconicness weigh? I could really be swayed either way, but I think Tony, yeah. Cops are Us are either going to be second or fourth.
Personally, here. Like, I feel like that we've always done this, that, you know, the things that are alike are next to each other, and we don't go for sort of like symmetry in a tier.
Yeah, I think it's fair to move Tony and Sarah up to the second slot. And I think that, you know, it is with the knowledge that these other two couples here are here for a little bit of a different reason than mm-hmm. Tony and Sarah and Robin.
Yeah.
They were here to make friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kevin, how are you feeling about all of that?
You know, as long as they're above JT and Steven and Malcolm Denise, I'll take
that's
it.
That's no problem. No problem there. No problem.
I'm willing to move Crystal and Kenny down one by one as long as this stays intact.
Fine. Okay. They are the barrier against JT and Steven and Malcolm and Denise. All right.
Police barrier.
All right. Then let's talk about one of our last two couples.
All right. We talked about them before. You cannot talk about Survivor duos by not talking about the only Survivor duo to ever tie in a final tribal council vote. Lean yourself up against that tree, folks. We are talking Dominic and Wendell.
Okay, this is going to be, I think, really fascinating, because I feel like that coming out of this season, coming out of Ghost Island, I feel like there was a lot of discourse about, like, well, where do Wendell and Dominic rank amongst the all-time Survivor power couples? Kevin, we will answer that question right now.
I think Dominic and Wendell are good players at Survivor, but maybe they're a little too competent to be, you know, this epic list of people that
wait, I think we've
how
could you be too competent to be an iconic Survivor power couple?
Because I think it's just missing that extra zest, you know, that's happening here. You know, the one reason I really am drawn to Crystal and Kenny and Rich and Rudy is that they represent different perspectives. They have a certain synergy together. They represent outside the show. Dominic and Wendell are from the same part of the country. They work in similar industries. They're only 5 years apart in age. The fact that these two people who are fairly socially competent, athletic individuals do well at Survivor isn't particularly interesting. interesting or different or special. And, you know, the most interesting thing about them essentially is that they have the tie at the end. And, it's, you know, I think that is impressive, but God, they made Ghost Island even longer. Like, I am not interested in this couple at all. Of the 20 that we had, hey,
didn't you two end up together because of Ghost Island? There's no reverence.
Wendell,
because we weren't paying attention in the finale. We were busy flirting with each other because it was so awful. It was so awful. And I think, like I said, Dom and Wendell deserve a lot of credit for playing a really good game. But so did Kim and Chelsea. And I'm going to put them on this list either.
Wow.
Just because you're competent does not mean you're interesting as a group. They did not make Ghost Island more interesting because of their dynamic. I did not find myself moved by it, even though they are very good players. What instills with one another? What makes them value each other other than that they're friends? I don't see it. I don't get it. And I'm not moved. Okay. And that's why it's hard for me to put them in that first tier. But I recognize it feels like they should at least be in that JT, Steven, Denise, Malcolm, like area, because they are, you know, such an obvious pairing.
Nigel, are you this hot about the anti Wendell and Dominic case?
We could never come up with a portmanteau from them, even 3 years later.
Yeah. What, by the way, what's the what's the name for them?
Team Overtime.
Overtime.
You know. Overtime, that tiebreaker, and making it go longer than necessary.
Yes, okay. Phil Kogan is excited.
They're going to have to make horseshoes or climb a beam to win the vote at the final tribal council.
Yeah, yeah. Nigel, go ahead. Tell them why they're fine.
You know, I think that a little bit of the issue for me with these two in preventing them from being a top-tier duo is that their dynamic is not particularly unique. We've discussed the brother relationship before. I think what really cements these two as an iconic duo is the fact that they worked together, got to the end and tied, and no one else has done that, right? So that in itself, I think, has to make them stand out from the crowd. But, you know, I think that let's say in Bizarro World, one of them gets idled out at Final Five, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that they would be remembered for their dynamic or their relationship necessarily. I think they would be remembered as like a strong duo in the way that like Tommy and Lauren were, as well as like another new school successful partnership, right? So for me, they don't have a lot of the same necessarily like pop in some of these different characters coming together as some of these other duos, but I think that you can't argue with their success, right?
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say of the pairs we've talked about, these are the two best players. I think the game that they played in Ghost Island really is from a partner perspective, especially considering that the new school game between the 20 person cast and the 13 person merge and the fact that Ghost Island brought so many advantages into the game. The fact that they still made the top two positions is an absolutely incredible feat. And I think what makes it so unique is exactly what Nigel is talking about, is I feel like, especially in the modern game, like the 30s, it is incredibly rare to have a twosome reach the final three.
Yeah.
Because usually what happens is like one of them goes out in fire, like Tony and Sarah, or one of them gets idled out or something happens. It's very rare that we get like the top a pair making the top two, like we see with a JT and Steven, or with a Rob and Amber, or with an Amanda and Parvati in a final three advantage laden era. That does feel special. I think that from a personality perspective, I agree. Maybe they're not necessarily up there, but I think that's also just the modern Survivor at it as well. Unfortunately, we saw a lot more of their gameplay as a pair than we did about their personalities as a pair.
And this duo, I think, is very interesting. Again, this is another duo that's forged in fire, where they end up on the wrong side of the vote when James Lim ends up and Laurel and Donovan come. They get switched over, and then they end up trying to make this move against Angela, and it completely blows up in their face. And they're basically like, hey, we're screwed. But they say, okay, well, Dominic has an idol, and they end up like clawing back from there. And they end up on the same side of things and working all their way back. And when we compare them to Steven and JT, I think what's interesting is that Steven and JT, what we've learned over the years, are both flawed players in that they're both missing like the other half that the other half has. And together, combined, they're able to complete each other. Whereas Wendell and Dominic, I think, are probably together both more well-rounded players than either Steven or JTR. Together, they were unstoppable.
Yeah, they were.
With the help of Laurel, with all, and also, and don't forget about Laurel, who, as we've talked about with whether it's Taj or Katie Gallagher or Suri, you know, are a very integral part of getting this twosome to the final three.
Right. But to that point, Ghost Island, to Kevin's chagrin, was all about Dominic and Wendell.
Yes.
Like, you could say Survivor Token Sheens was about JT and Steven and Coach and Tyson and a little bit of Aaron and Taj. But Ghost Island, to its detriment, was pretty much entirely about Wendell and Dominic.
And about Laurel not going away from them.
A little bit, but they were still focused on Wendell and Dominic.
Yes.
Right? It was still like, oh, do I betray Wendell and Dominic? So I think the fact that, again, this season, they make that season, for better or for worse, also holds a lot of weight. This is the season of Wendell and Dominic.
But to me, this list is about iconic Survivor power couples. Who were the most powerful couples? Not electric couples. Who was the most entertaining couples? But these are our powerful duos.
Yes, but, you know, there's something about best, you know, which is obviously very subjective. It's, you know, what we like and value. And I, at the end of the day, am just not very impressed. I think their personalities are a little too similar, even. Like, are there Enneagrams and their Myers-Briggs that different? Probably not.
What are their Enneagrams, Kevin?
They're definitely, it's like type 8 and type 9, and they're like the inverse of each other. That's definitely true, I think. Mm. It's just not, like, it is, like I said, I think Kim and Chelsea are also a really good pair, but I really don't even know what Dominic and Wendell really offer each other. Even like, you know, what did one do that the other didn't, and that they helped.
So, as somebody who recently watched this season, that I do feel like that, as you pointed out with the type 8 and the type 9, whereas I think that it was like sort of like the good cop, bad cop sort of thing, where I think that like it was a little bit like mom and dad, where Wendell like was able to sort of have a lot of the social relationships. And I think that Dom was more of the heavy. And I think that that was a great compliment in terms of like the way that they were able to co-lead this thing all the way down to the end, where I think that, you know, and to Dom's detriment, he made like some like probably like was too heavy on some of the threats towards the end of the game. And while Wendell was like a willing accomplice along the way, that I think he was seen as the more sympathetic figure. So I do think that their leadership styles together was very effective.
Yeah, and it was. I just think that Dom and Wendell at the, you know, with Rob and Amber, it was really a question to the jury that we've been getting foreshadowing the entire season. You know, Sheehan's vote for Amber is actually even told to us episodes earlier, where Sheehan and Colby have their conflict, right? And pretty much Sheehan says, you know, she wins out. And, you know, several episodes later, that under the radar strategy succeeds over Boston Rob, who is this big, a louder person. And so there's a more of a true dichotomy there.
Okay.
Certainly, I think Dom is the more social, is the more strategic player, and Wendell is the more social player. But I'm not even sure if that's like, certainly that was their mission. Like, it's not like they didn't have like objectives. It's just, one just happened to be more like, one had a 10% better social game than the other, and that was the difference at the end of the day. Why do this set of five vote for Dom and the set of five vote for Wendell is really missing, I think, beyond just like, these are the people you tend to like, where in All Stars, at least the jury, when they were deciding things, you actually saw like a point of view being realized. That's just not happening here. And I just, it's hard for me to really put them that high up there when I just feel like there's so much more I'm asking for. You know, you want to be an iconic Survivor power couple, give me something to work with beyond a literal resume. It's there's something really missing for me.
Okay. Mike, I feel like that we haven't heard your point of reference on this.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a character counts person. So, I mean, from my perspective, you know, are Wendell and Dominic people that I'm like, yes, I would love to spend hours and hours talking about their dynamic? No, because their dynamic wasn't necessarily the focus on this. These were two guys that seemed to just gel really well together. They weren't from opposite points of walks of life, even though it's nice that these two guys come from very different backgrounds, in my opinion, and are able to see common ground. I do think there's value in that. But we've been talking so much about legacy and survivor history over the course of this. I think we've been remiss to not put Dominic and Wendell in the top tier. I know it's a bit of recency bias considering it was four seasons ago, but it is so, again, I will say it is so just wild in the modern day and age that we had a final tribal council where it's people saying like, I don't know how to separate these two guys. That speaks to how much of like an amorphous blob they were. And the fact that they literally wielded so much power as a couple has to make this one of the top survivor power couples, in my opinion, even if their personalities were not as sterling as some of the others occupying the top tier.
Kevin and Nigel don't like it.
You know, I think that for me, I'm looking at our worth playing for versus my life is fine. And, you know, I think if you compare them to JT and Steven, technically, Dom and Wendell are more successful because they both came as close to winning as you can without actually winning on that first jury vote, if you will. So I think technically that does make them more successful than JT and Steven. But for me, I don't think that the dynamic between the two of them and who they are as characters on the show enter a level of transcending beyond just who they are in a way that I think the other four couples in the worth playing for category do for me. So I would put them as first in line at my life is fine.
Well, I feel like there is some synergy to have them with Steven and JT. Kevin, if they are yes, next to Steven and JT, but ahead of Steven and JT, how do you feel about that?
You know, I personally prefer Steven and JT over Dom and Wendell. But that's because I prefer most pairs over Dom and Wendell, for the record. Mm. If this is where they're going to end up, I am happy with this. And I do think it makes sense that they are in the same tier as JT, Steven, Malcolm, and Denise, because I do think they are iconic pairings that certainly have a story that's tied. But, you know, I'm just not the most moved by it. What's the best part of Ghost Island, the pre-merge? You mean the time when they have the least amount of power? I wonder why. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not for me.
Yeah. Mike, who do you think had the harder road to the end of the game, Steven and JT or Wendell and Dominic?
Wendell and Dominic, 100%. Yeah. Steven and JT had Coach and Debbie being like, oh, yes, can I serve you, my masters? Please let me give you this reward.
But in fairness, that they I think they did more to prevent Laurel from flipping. I think that was the best thing they did. I think that the Navidi group did a lot to self-destruct on their own also. I think that Kellen is the coach in that scenario.
But I also think that there's so many other dynamics in view, right? Like, you could be like, great, we have a 4-3 majority wrapped up. Oh, great, here's an extra vote and an idol. You're now screwed. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist in Survivor Token Genes. There are so many more facets of the game that exist in Survivor 36 than Survivor 18. Literally double the amount of seasons, have passed. So I think that Wendell and Dominic just had so many other factors to deal with than Steven and JT. Steven and JT, like, I'm not poo-pooing their work. They had to work their way in. But I do feel like Wendell and Dominic had so much more.
Also, I think that they're also polar opposites in that Wendell and Dominic, that there was no distance between them. It's a 5-5 vote. Steven and JT, it is a 7-0 vote in favor of JT. And I think that speaks to the duo being more powerful. That is the more even duo as opposed to the one that was seen unanimously as the better player.
Yeah.
Does that hold up?
I think that that's a great point, Rob.
Okay. All right. One last power couple to talk about. Don't know if they're going to make it to our top tier, but Mike, who do you have?
Well, they made it to the loved ones visit. Pour out the grains. Let's play in the sand with Christian Hubicki and Gabby Pascuzzi from Survivor. Okay. David versus
Kevin. Tell me about Christian and Gabby making the list.
Yeah, team Revenge of the Nerds, team Nerdy and Wordy. You know, mm-hmm. I mean,
who's who?
There's just something about. Sorry,
who's who?
Who's who?
Yeah.
Oh, Christian's absolutely wordy.
Wordy.
Yeah, but also maybe Gabby because she's a technical writer. You know, like there's something really, I think,
It's like Pinky and the Brain for Crystal and Kenny. I think you could be either or, very dork-sided, if you will. And I like Gabby and Christian. I think the fact that they leaned on each other so much, and that Gabby then wants to vote Christian off, but then Christian gets one over on her at the very end, is a very interesting story about what we thought would be maybe a power couple actually disintegrating. So there, I think there are certain levels there that is really moving, even if they were not nearly as iconic or as powerful as some of the others.
Okay. All right. Nigel, any thoughts on Christian and Gabby?
Yeah, I think that Christian and Gabby are kind of interesting because there's a little bit of a question of recency bias, I think. We've only seen so many seasons since they played in David versus Goliath. But, you know, I think that there's something about them that has just a very fun, happy energy to them. It's to me, almost going back to Gabby asking Christian, will you play with me? It does feel like play. It's just, to me, a very positive experience watching them on screen. I don't know that the two of them together are going to be thought of as an iconic duo, mm-hmm. you know, 5 years down the road. But I don't think you can argue with the idea that you will think of them as a duo together. Yeah. I think that they are just so intertwined in their stories. Are they a successful power couple? That's more of a question, but they are both an important piece that helps flip the game for a period of time. So, you know, while they also might not be as successful as some of the other couples on the mm-hmm. list, I do think that they have earned a spot here, regardless of final.
Mike, Christian and Gabby.
Yeah, I mean, I think David versus Goliath has a slew of incredible survivor characters. I do think, though, that when you think of particular relationships from that season, Gabby and Christian might be the number one in terms of memorability, mm-hmm. despite the fact they make it to eighth and seventh place. Right. This is like going back to the Kenny and Crystal conversation of, well, their success doesn't necessarily bear out. But that's ironically enough, while Crystal and Kenny run out as each other's ride or dies, it's due to each other the reason that Christian and Gabby go out. Gabby decides, okay, I need to turn on Christian right now. So Christian's like forced to play his idol. And so he doesn't have it the next round that gets voted out right after Gabby. You know, I think it's and Christian doesn't even want to vote out Gabby. He voted for Allison. It's because Mike White and Angelina had the better sense about them. And it's like, oh, all the votes are going on here. Let's throw a couple of votes onto Gabby to get rid of her. So it's almost a tragic breakup of the power couple in that regard. But I think it's a really fun constant.
Sure.
Throughout David versus Goliath. Is it iconic? No, but is it important? Yes, especially to season 37.
All right, well, let's take a look at where we're going to place Christian and Gabby. So I don't think that they're going to be to Forget You Go Home. Goodbye. I feel like they have a place somewhere here in Ain't No Hershey Bar. I don't think that...
I would put them above Cochran and Dawn, at least.
Cochran. So, okay, so that's interesting. I was going to say that I feel like that they're around here with Colby and Jerry. You want to split up the child-parent relationships.
Yeah, I don't know. I do feel like, again, maybe it's recency bias. I just feel like Christian and Gabby's relationship was just such an important part of the narrative of David versus Goliath, whereas maybe Dawn and Cocker's relationship really wasn't as integral mm-hmm.
okay.
or caramel.
Kevin, where do you think Christian and Gabby should be?
I will put them right above Pascal and Nalia. That way we keep, you know, these two more like familial pairs together. And, you know, I think there's a lot of interest and intrigue. You know, if they told us the next cast has Christian and Gabby in it, I think a lot of us would be very like, that'd be fun, right? To see what the relationship is like, how they played with each other. And, you know, just like how Pascal and Nalia, their stories are very much linked. And how like Pascal like loses because of Nalia, because he cares about her so much. I think it's like the inverse with Gabby and Christian. So having them next to each other makes sense to me.
Okay. Nigel, how do you feel?
You know, I think that I would actually put them behind Dawn and Cochran. Ooh. Next to Colby and Jerry, because, you know, Dawn and Cochran and Pascal and Nalia are both much more successful in their outings as duos as Christian or compared to Christian and Gabby. As we said, they're, I believe, seventh and eighth placers. And I think that you know, if we're placing couples next to each other who have similar dynamics. I recall at the time there were some fans online asking Gabby if she had a crush on Christian. And so I think that, you know, putting them next to Colby and Jerry, it's an actual platonic relationship.
Yeah.
Maybe some outside observers were suggesting it was more than that. But in reality, it was truly a platonic relationship.
The two that people think are a couple but aren't really a couple. I think that there's some synergy there.
Turn it to match game. We're just flipping over cards of what's similar between these.
Yeah,
things.
Well, I think that that's part of like if something you think one thing, it's like that sorts to help to crystal cock-size your thoughts on something.
don't ever say crystal cock-size.
No,
again,
I do, like, we're 3 hours in, Mike. We're gonna have some duds. Okay, there you go. All right, let's take a look at the list. Let's see what we have here. All right, let's work from the bottom up. Okay. Forget You Go Home Goodbye. We have led off by Abby Maria and Pete, and then Shane and Courtney. Okay. Two dysfunctional couples here.
Yeah, I like Shane and Courtney on the bottom. It's going to be the cherry on top of their pretty poo-poo day when they find out that they are the worst survivor power couple.
Okay. All right. Any objections here?
You know, I think it's poetic that essentially two hot mess duos are the two that find themselves in the bottom together. So I'm happy with
okay.
it. Me too.
All right. Then we go to Ain't No Hershey Bar. Okay. The next five are going to be Pascal and Nalia, Dawn and Cochran, sort of like a parent-child type relationships. With Christian and Gabby, followed by Jerry and Colby, and Coach and Tyson.
I mean, look, I mean, I'm sort of like Dominic and Wendell when it comes to Cochran and Dawn. I really don't feel anything about them. Maybe it's because I really do not like Survivor Karamoan. I feel much more stuff about Christian and Gabby and Colby and Jerry than I do Dawn and Cochran. But I mean, the arguments that you gave earlier were fine. If I had my druthers, I would bump Dawn and Cochran down. But again, if we're doing a little bit of match game here, I'm fine with keeping the parent-child relationships together.
Do we want to drop both of them below? Should the Pascal and Nalia and Dawn and Cochran be after Jerry and Colby? That a bridge too far?
Do you mean drop them just lower in Ain't No Hershey Bar?
No, drop them. Yeah. Basically, put Christian and Gabby and Jerry and Colby ahead of the Pascal and Nalia and Dawn and Cochran.
I think that makes sense because then Dawn and Cochran are also close to Coach and Tyson, who I think are obviously linked. There's certainly something left to be desired. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mike, does that feel better to you? So Christian and Gabby, followed by Jerry and Colby, and then Pascal and Nalia, and then Dawn and Cochran, and then Coach and Tyson.
Yeah, this feels right to me. I think that, you know, these are all substantial, but I just feel like the more we talked about Christian and Gabby and Jerry and Colby in particular, like, it was a good bookend, I think, in our discussion right. of like, these are these couples that like contributed to each other's downfalls, but were also like very important to the storylines of the overall season.
Okay. Then My Life is Fine. This is our deepest tier, 9 deep. Okay. We start with Dominic and Wendell, then Steven and JT, then Malcolm and Denise, Parvati and Amanda, Parvati and Russell, Jenna and Heidi, Tom and Ian, Laura and Sierra, and Kelly and Sue.
I think this is a good order. Obviously, I would rather put, I think, the first three pairs here towards the bottom, but that's just personal taste, but I think this is a consistent order because you see these like really strong pairs who were on the same starting tribes. Then you move on to the Parvatis, then you move on to, I think, like these familial relationships. And it makes sense that Sue and Kelly are right above Christian and Gabby, who also have a bit of a tumultuous relationship at the very, very end.
I'll be candid. It feels weird to me to have Wendell and Dominic and JT and Steven in the second tier. Maybe it's because I'm a Survivor basic bitch, but it just feels odd to not have them in the top tier, even if it's below our top four.
That's fine with me.
Okay. So in this scenario, we're moving Wendell and Dominic and Steven and JT to fifth and sixth place, respectively.
on worth playing for.
Because I think that I'm fine personally separating them out from Malcolm and Denise, because I feel like Malcolm and Denise, while it was a story of the season, it was not the story of the season. I think that, you know, Kevin and Nigel made some great points about how, like, Lisa and Scoop.
A lot of Penner in there also.
A lot of Penner. We had Abby and Pete have a story and artists along there as well. Whereas Token Sheens and Ghost Island are really fundamentally about the final two people that made the end game there.
Okay. All right. And then our top tier, Robin Amber, Tony and Sarah, Rich and Rudy, Rudy and Nudie. We have Smash and Dash, Kenny and Crystal, Wendell and Dominic, and Steven and JT round out the top tier.
I'm very happy with the order that we have for the top tier here. I also think it makes sense moving Dom and Wendell and JT and Steven up a tier, because that brings the numbers a little bit more even between the tiers as well. So I think that there is a logical explanation as to why everybody is where they are on the list right now. Overall, I think this is
okay.
Yeah, I know some people will take issue with Crystal and Kenny being that far, but just rewind the podcast a bit to where I spoke.
Yes. Okay.
If you need proof.
All right. Take a screenshot. That's your list here of Survivor's iconic power couples. Okay. Great job once again. And we did it. Kevin and Nigel, thank you for spending some time with us to go through it. This was a great list.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, thanks for having us. You know, as an iconic Survivor power duo, you know, we were really excited to be able to look at dynamics specifically, because I think that, you know, at least my viewership of the show has evolved over time to better appreciate the characters and the dynamics between people. Whereas I think when I first started, especially as a fan coming in through Survivor Kagyan, I think that I used to be much more focused just on strategy and dynamics of gameplay. And so it was fun to be able to get more in depth into the actual social relationships, which are fundamental to the show that is Survivor.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really exciting. You know, Nigel and I were talking about the list earlier about, well, who's who and which of the dynamics. Who's the Dom? Who's the Wendell? Who's this? Who's that? And I think we came down to, if the person's going to win, it's probably Nigel. And if the person's going to make a big fuss, it's probably me. So I think it's a fun activity. Any couples out there, think about who you are in those relationships and learn something about yourself too. It's like the Enneagram, you know? Like, it's good stuff. Yeah.
All right. Well, I love the Enneagram. So you're talking my language. All right, Kevin and Nigel, where can people keep up with you?
It's probably easiest to find me on Instagram. Yes. I am at Nigel Speed.
On Instagram, I am at Asian Narcissist. But you can also follow me at Twitter at Asian Narc, which is just Asian Narcissist with a few less letters.
Yes.
We're recording this on 420, so hopefully people have been blowing up your account, Kevin.
Another important reason to follow Kevin on Instagram, he had mentioned it when we played the Patron Family yes. Feud game. He is in the middle of doing a hottest senators poll, essentially. It's a tournament being voted on in his Insta story. So follow him and you'll get to keep up with it. It's fun.
Yeah, we're down to the top eight. It's very, very exciting. Ooh. More interesting than those politics. Okay. So, you know. I do that.
All right. The great eight. Go check out Kevin's Instagram if you want to see who made the cut. All right. Mike, what's coming up for you?
Lots of stuff. So, you know, I heard the name invoked of Lost Down the Hatch. We have finished up season four. We're finishing up season
four.
Look
at you guys.
This week, taking a little bit of a break before we get into season five, which jumps all over the years, much like we did over the course of this podcast. Of course, my wife and I are doing the Bloom Files, which is an X-Files podcast, where we are rounding out season three, moving into season four. And then The Falcon and the Winter Soldier is finishing up. It has been a wackadoo series, but it's been a lot of fun to cover with Kevin Mahadeo and LaTanya Starks. And then over on the reality TV side of things, for Parade.com, I'm doing exit press for Top Chef and The Circle. At the time this is out, you should have an interview with the contestant or contestants eliminated from this week's episodes of The Circles over at Parade.com, which was a very fun group of conversations. And then from a podcast perspective, I mentioned this at the beginning, but Survivor South Africa season 8 is around the corner. Shannon, Gus, and I got some preseason interviews where we got to send in some questions and the contestants answered them. I've been going through and editing them so far. It's a really fun group of people. So as soon as that cast drops, we're going to be cramming your podcast feed full of cast previews and much more to come. And one final thing that I'll plug. So I am wearing my Sunday buff in honor of course, the late Sunday Burquest, who unfortunately lost the battle with cancer this past weekend. And of course, the Survivor community is mourning such a genuine, bright light, someone who I'm sure was the source behind many power couple in Survivor season 33. That being said, the journey continues to fight for the cure to cancer that takes so many people like Sunday each and every day. So if you are inspired, like I know I am, standuptocancer.org, make any donations that you can. I know that Survivor has been linked to Stand Up to Cancer for a long time, years on years on years. So it's always tough to lose someone in the Survivor family, especially to such a devastating disease. But let's hope we can put our dollars to use and make sure that, you know, this does that we prevent, you know, others from unfortunately succumbing to the dangers of cancer that comes. So again, standuptocancer.org, donate.
And Sunday is such a great lady that I really enjoyed all of my conversations with her. We spoke to her last summer when she first got the diagnosis of the two different cancers that she was facing last year. And she was just like so brave going into the battle that she was fighting. And she kept saying, you know, the stage has been set. And she put on such a brave face to the world to try to remind people to, you know, to keep battling and to, you know, keep just putting on like, you know, a fight. And she was just so inspiring to get to talk to and hear all the different messages that she made throughout her, you know, ongoing battle. And we really miss Sunday. So, lots of thoughts to her cast and her family and everybody whose lives that she touched in the Survivor community. This was really, really fun to do this once again, Kevin and Nigel. Of course, we'll continue bringing you more Survivor Outwit, Outplay, Outlist as we go through this very extended Survivor offseason. For even more Survivor coverage, check out our Survivor Samoa panel. We'll be doing our Survivor Samoa feedback show over on the Patreon feed later on this weekend. Check that out at robhasawebsite.com/patron for more information. That being said, can't wait to do it again. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye. Support for this podcast comes from our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and it's hard work, but you know what's easy? Bundling with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance, and it's a good thing, too. You're busy enough. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today.
Hey, movie lovers, who needs a theater when you have Pluto TV? Grab your popcorn and your streaming device because free movies are here. Pluto TV is your home for movies. Great movies are playing anytime in over 20 exclusive movie channels of action, horror, rom-coms, and more. Watch hits like Saving Private Ryan, Pretty in Pink, and Charlie's Angels all for free. No signups, no fees, no contracts, ever. Download the free Pluto TV app on any device.